Johnson, and I'm joined as always by my main man, Pots and Pans, Nick McCona, Philly voice and Philly influencer, and we got a very, very special guest in the building for a very, very special episode, I should say, of the Straight Shooters, where we've done our deep dives, but we haven't really had guests on our deep dives. I know we had a Patreon guest before for a couple of minutes, but now we got somebody who's in the trenches of one of our deep dives. We're going to deep dive into the lone WrestleMania that took place in Philadelphia, WrestleMania 15. And we got the hometown hero of that show, Blue Meanie, to talk about all the things surrounding the show and deep dive right along with this. Blue Meanie, I'm going to check in with you though, Nick. I'm going to check in with you too, but we got a special guest. I got to check in with my guy, Blue Meanie. How are you doing today, my good Blue brother? How are you doing today?
I'm doing good, man. I'm glad I could be here. I know I had to jump through a couple hoops, a couple flaming hoops to get here, but I'm here and I'm happy. I'm glad you guys asked me to come on. Yeah, man, these guys are great. You know, you're good people. You know, great guys. Enjoy the show. So, yeah, thanks for having me on, man, on this deep dive into my WrestleMania moment in my hometown of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
Exactly. So, yeah, thanks for coming on. Thanks for joining us. Thanks man. For good. Fitness into your busy schedule.
But it's crazy. It's crazy. I have to help other people out, but I'm glad to help other people out. But also, you know, I got my stuff I got to do, too. So I'm such as this. So I'm glad I'm here.
Exactly. So you host your own podcast as well, The Mind of Meanie. If you want to tell the folks where they can find your podcast.
Yeah, my podcast, which we just had the 1 year episode, Mind of the Meanie, drops every Monday morning at 6 a.m. You can also watch the video version of Mind of the Meanie exclusive. Well, not exclusively, because it airs the next night on our YouTube.com/ Mind of the Meanie YouTube page. But Monday night at 6 p.m., you can go over to Fight TV and watch the video version of Mind of the Meanie, which you can watch for absolutely free. It's kind of like the old Howard Stern show where you can listen to the show and then later on that night on the E channel, you know, you can watch some clips from that show you just watched that morning or whatever. And I'm sure somebody will pick it apart and go, well, actually it was from a couple weeks ago, but whatever, you can watch it on Fight TV. So yeah, we're busy over at the World and Mind of Meanie, myself and Josh Chernoff, having a lot of fun, and can't believe it's been a year, man. Wow.
There you go. Over on Fight TV. So Straight Shooters listeners, go check it out. Support the good brother, Brian Heffern. Blue Meanie has always been good to us from day one.
Anytime this is my real name, I assume I'm in trouble. Mr. Heffern, step into the room. What I do now, you know, principal's office.
Yeah, use a shoot name here and there, but, you know.
Yeah. It's all good.
It's all good. But, Nick, I know you're good having a good day today, because today is opening day for the Phillies here in Philly, right? They're playing at home, right?
They are.
In 40-degree weather.
I hope they are. Otherwise, we sound really stupid right now. But, yeah, it's
one game
Christmas.
Did get postponed for COVID. I don't know if you saw that.
Not surprising. The Nationals and Mets, I believe. So, you know, that's going to happen. And it's going to happen the rest of the year. So, I really – it's my Christmas today. So, yeah. I'm excited. Phillies are my number one love. If I had to rank them, they would be up there, but I don't like ranking them because I love my sports teams equally, but I've been following the Phillies since 93 and like that year. So what a year to start following them.
What a magical year.
It was absolutely incredible. And I remember, you know, I was told I had an imaginative mind when I was that young, because I told my teacher that I went to Toronto for a World Series game like the previous night. She's like, really? You went to Toronto and you're in school today? And I was like, yeah, it's not that far. You know, like, I didn't know how far away it was. I didn't know the map yet in second grade or third grade, I should say. I was in third grade. I didn't really know the map yet. So, yeah, I'm pumped, ready to hopefully finally have the Phillies make the playoffs for the first time in 10 years. And
it would be nice.
So
I did an article for Sports Illustrated where I did a breakdown of how that 93 Phillies team was just like the ECW roster, you know. And yeah, I'll have to send you the link. I know we're here for the deep dive for WrestleMania, but I'll send you the link. And you know, that, you know, the characters on that 93 Phillies team remind me a lot of ECW. ECW was...
We may need to do a deep dive on that eventually.
Yeah. ECW, I tell everybody, you watch every sports movie like Major League or Slapshot, and that was ECW. And we lived that, you know, we lived those movies, you know.
The 93 Phillies is one of those teams that people still talk about, even though they didn't win the World Series. They talk about that team almost as fondly as they talk about the 08 team that actually won the World Series. It's not going to say strange. It's just really odd how that happens in Philly. Like, the people, if you probably ask a lot of people who their favorite Phillies team is, especially if they're of a certain age, maybe the younger generation will probably say the 08 team because that's their team.
Right.
But if you're over 30 into your 40s, maybe even 50s, you're probably going to say the 93 team is just as popular or just as fun to watch as that 08 team, that team that won it all, instead of the team that had a heartbreaking loss in Game 6 in Toronto. So,
yeah, and that just goes down to characters get over more than wins and losses, you know?
There you go. So it's a lesson, a wrestling lesson right there.
Yeah, it is.
It's a wrestling lesson right there. But let's get back in that way back machine. Not quite to 1993. Let's go back to 1999. Where Philadelphia hosts its one and only to date. Hopefully that'll change soon. It's one and only WrestleMania. Me and Nick were saying on the podcast for a while, Meanie, that we're thinking WrestleMania's gonna come back in 2026 because it's like the 250th anniversary of the country, and we already got the baseball All-Star game coming that year. So we're hoping, crossing fingers, that they'll bring in WrestleMania that year too. But for now, we got 1999. We got March 28th, 1999. At the time was known as the First Union Center, now known as the Wells Fargo Center. We're going to talk about that a little bit as well. But, Brian, let's talk about you for a second. kind of talk about where you were in your life at that point, heading into WrestleMania. You know, just kind of take me back into your mind at that time, heading into WrestleMania, before WrestleMania even happens. You know it's in your hometown. You know you got a lot going on you got a match to worry about. Talk to us about your state of mind heading into WrestleMania back in 99.
It was interesting because, you know, I come into WWE and I'm indoctrinated into WWE through the Job Squad with Al Snow, Scorpio, Bob Holly, Gilbert. And, you know, the Job Squad was doing pretty good. And then somewhere along the line, they start breaking up the Job Squad. Scorpio got released, which it sucks for him, but in a way it kind of works out for me because then they start putting me on the house show loops, teaming with Bob Holly as a member of the Job Squad. And, you know, as a young kid, you know, being on the road for WWE and, but, you know, I don't know how it is now, but back then, if you were in WWE, you wanted to be on those house show loops because that's where you made the real money. You know, people are like, oh, you're on TV. You're making money. No, you make money going to live events. Right. So I was doing pretty good. Yeah, I was teaming with Bob every night, wrestling Edge and Christian. Leading up to that, like I said, they start breaking up the Job Squad. And I was just trying to find my way. So when, you know, they did the angle where Goldust stole Al Snow's head. And I'm like, oh, man, you know, they're breaking up the Job Squad. It's an opportunity for me to get back into the fold. So I go up to Vince Russo and I pitch, hey, Goldust stole Al Snow's head. I'm with Al Snow in the Job Squad. ECW, I was Blue Dust. Now, Goldust is the character that is that plays the mind games. What if I bring back Blue Dust and play mind games with the guy who plays mind games in order to get Al Snow's head back? And I watched him process it, and he started chewing his gum, and he was like, yeah, bro, yeah. And then he pitched it, and he's like, yeah, you're going to do it. And then I had a match against Goldust at St. Valentine's Day Massacre in Memphis. And that was February 14th in Memphis. Yeah. Yep.
Yeah, St. Valentine's Day Massacre. We talked about that in the podcast a couple weeks back, around Valentine's Day.
I'm getting to that age where I have to say things out loud to remember them. so hence, you know, I start having this mini feud with Goldust, and we turn around and start teaming. which, you know, leads me into WrestleMania, where, like, you know, if I hadn't pitched that idea where I feud with Goldust, it might not have led into me eventually teaming with Goldust, and, you know, which led to me, you know, being in Goldust's corner going into WrestleMania, which was, you know, when you, you know, there's certain feelings you remember. Like, I remember when I, you know, first got signed by WWE, the electricity that went through my body as soon as I hung up that phone and was able to go to the next room and tell my folks to put all the bills in my name. Because, and you know, when I found out, you know, we're going to be a part of WrestleMania, and it's in my hometown of Philadelphia in front of, you know, friends and family, there's a jolt that goes through you. You know, it's like, you know, any scene out of a movie, you know, and in some ways you could say, oh, if that was in the movie, it'd be too corny, but it was my movie moment. So, I like it. So yeah, going up to that, you know, you just sometimes, you know, around this time of year, I reflect on WrestleMania's past, whether it's the first time I ever went to a WrestleMania. Like, you know, I watched the first three on closed circuit with my grandfather at resorts in Atlantic City, went to 4 and 5 by myself, but my grandpa got sweet tickets because he worked for Trump Plaza. And then, you know, the first time I watched WrestleMania in my home live was WrestleMania 6, because, you know, that was like the pay-per-view had been around, but I hadn't had a reason to get a WWE pay-per-view until, or WrestleMania on pay-per-view until WrestleMania 6. So, you know, flash forward, you know, 9 years, and then, you know, from watching it on pay-per-view of WrestleMania 6, and now I'm going to be on WrestleMania 15. It's so bizarre. It's kind of like, it's like my Vince Papale moment, you know?
Right. Obviously, like you said, it's a big deal. You grew up here. You're a 444 fan, root for all the teams. Then you also worked for the promotion that was like pretty much a fifth favorite, everybody's fifth favorite team here in Philly, in ECW. So,
yeah,
that's a dope moment. That's a dope moment that a lot of wrestlers don't get, especially not just out of WrestleMania, but also your WrestleMania in your hometown. Like, how many people can say that?
And it makes you think, man, because, you know, there's so many wrestlers from Philly and a lot of wrestlers I consider more talented than myself who never had the opportunity. So, you know, the other day I posted, you know, my memory of being at WrestleMania 15, and Tom Brandy, Sal Sincere, reached out with a text saying, hey, happy WrestleMania Day, man. You know, and Tom Brandy is a guy who, you know, when I was just a fan, I was thinking about becoming a wrestler. I met Tom Brandy at a convention. I was like, yeah, I'm thinking about getting into the wrestling business. How old are you? And I think I was 17 at the time. He's like, oh, it's perfect. You go do it, you know? And he gave me that motivation. And we're still friends all these years later.
Do you think he was sincere about it?
Sincere.
I'll take five.
See your way out.
Sit this one out. No, but seriously, you think about all the opportunities I've had. And then, you know, of other people who would kill to be in that moment. And you just, it makes you appreciate the opportunity to have like a storybook moment in your career. I debuted for ECW in Philly, debuted for WWE in Philly, my WrestleMania moments in Philly. You know, the only thing that would have topped it off is if I could have came back to the Rumble in Philly, you know. Yeah,
that should have happened too. WWE dropped the ball on that, by the way.
It almost happened, but c'est la vie. Yeah.
They had two chances to do it and didn't do it. Damn it. Should have happened. So.
Well, they do the crowd with her. We turned on Roman, and they would have booed Nakamura. So.
Yeah, it came down to me and Buff. I didn't mean to step on your joke there, man. I'm sorry. But it came down to me and Bubba. They chose Bubba, and I get it. So no hard feelings.
You mentioned, you know, you're going to be able to have this moment in front of your friends and family. Yeah. What was the logistics like of taking care of them as far as like tickets and stuff like that? Like, what was that all like? I know, like, we went to the Super Bowl a couple of years ago, and the players always talk about getting tickets for everybody. It's hectic. You know, I let my wife or whoever do that. And I know for me, and I didn't have as many tickets and responsibilities as players, it was still a hectic, like, 24 hours for me to have to figure everything out.
Yeah.
This is WrestleMania. How was it for you trying to take care of everybody in the lead up to this?
It wasn't too bad. I had brought my family to a prior, just regular house show, and that wasn't too bad. But, you know, they had a special – It's funny, I was watching it because I leading up to this, I rewatched WrestleMania 15 just to refresh my memory. And I remember there was like a family suite, like a suite for wives and husbands, family, whatever. And after my deal, I washed up and I went up to the family suite. That's the word I'm looking for, suite. And I got up there right in time to see Triple H turn on X-Pac. And like anytime I watch X-Pac versus X-Pac get turned on by Triple H, I kind of look for I was sitting right up there watching just with my family and folks and stuff like that. So yeah, just like certain things bring back certain memories, but the logistics wasn't too bad.
How many people did you have? Did you have like 30, 40 people there?
It wasn't that bad. It wasn't that bad. Keep it. Yeah. You know, keep my circle small. So, it wasn't too bad. So, thankfully for me, most of my family hated wrestling and made fun of me for liking wrestling as a kid. So I didn't have to worry about those folks. So, media family and stuff like that. So
even when you got to WWE, you figure like by the time you get to WWE, they'd be like, oh, well, maybe this is working out for Brian here. Like, I can see if you're on the indies and stuff like that, maybe they're still scoffing at it, but WWF is a big time.
Oh, they liked it, when they can hit me up for money. But, that's great. You're in WWE. Woo. Got $5. other than that, they still scoffed at it. Oh, it's fake. How can you watch that fake thing? I was like, I don't know. How do you watch TV? How do you go to the movies? It's entertainment,
Also, that money is real.
Yeah, it was.
There's nothing fake about that money.
Yeah, Uncle Sam got most of it, but yeah.
it be that way.
that's the one thing people don't realize, whoever you make in wrestling, take 50% of that and just throw that towards the government and travel and expenses and stuff like that. So it's like, it's that cartoon where the guy's pulling out his pockets, just like, wah, wah.
I gotta get me one of those.
Oh, dude, you gotta get yourself a Roadcaster, man. These things are fantastic.
Love it. We used to do, we were in the studio, we would have like Keenan and Kel bits. Just like, hits from that. And that was like my favorite thing to do in the studio, just play those and Kel bits, man.
I keep forgetting how much older I am than you guys. You're like, man, my first Philly season was 93. I was like, son of a bitch, I was graduating high school.
Well, the funny thing is I had just started playing baseball too, because I guess my parents wanted me to at least do something outside of the house. So I was like, I'll try baseball, and I fell in love with it. So it was like the same year I started watching the Phillies. So it just kind of worked out. Thankfully, it worked out for me. My first WrestleMania was WrestleMania 6. So yeah, I didn't watch it live, but I watched it. My babysitter and her family were huge wrestling fans. So when I would stay over there, they got me into it. And WrestleMania 6, I was like, wow, like this is awesome.
That's awesome. Very cool.
Yeah.
So we've been to WrestleMania since 1999. And the whole week leading up is like a big deal. They have the Access Convention. They have all the independent shows surrounding the event. I'm sure you've probably taken part in a couple here and there. In the last decade and a half, they've had these big independent shows surrounding WrestleMania. What was the week like back in 99, especially for a WWF talent? I'm sure you probably were. I don't know. Were you busy? Were you doing a lot of radio hits, a lot of interviews? And after that, we got to talk about the WrestleMania Rage Party, because we did a deep dive on that back in last August. Right. And we're still wondering, what the hell was that? But first, talk about the week leading up. Just what was that like for you and the other guys too? How was it hectic? Was it not so hectic? Did you have a good time? What was it like?
It was pretty much just like, it almost felt like you were just doing, I mean, WrestleMania is a big thing, but you kind of felt like you're just leading up to another, Monday Night Raw or whatever. I did an interview for the Philadelphia Inquirer or Daily News, whichever one. I think I saw the article. They did an article on the hometown guy doing WrestleMania in his hometown and stuff like that. And then there was the day before, there was a thing on a Saturday. We did a meet and greet on the boat, and the boat went up and down the Delaware for a little bit, and we came back. We had lunch, and it was me and Goldust with a couple fans. And a fan was kind enough to send me an 8x10 from that thing, or I would have totally forgot about it. But pretty cool. But other than that, it was basically just hanging out. And then, like you said, we did the Rage Party on Saturday night. And then the next day, you know, you show up for WrestleMania like you're showing up for TVs. You know, it's just like it felt like another TV, but hey, it's the biggest show of the year. No pressure. if you watch that WrestleMania, man, I'm breaking out in a sweat just from, you know, nerves and stuff like that. And my paint's wearing off. And you know, I was just like, I'm going to make sure they say my name. leading up to it. I mean, it sounds so, I don't want to sound like, you know, so blah, but it felt like, you know, it's leading up to another TV and stuff like that, you know, which, you know, that, you know, far into the business, you're kind of used to doing press and stuff like that, doing interviews. And so it was cool to be in the Inquirer, you know, and in the photos, me, clotheslining Draws, who's another area native. So it was like PA on New Jersey crime in the photo right there. So, yeah, and it was really cool. It was leading up to it and doing the lunch on the ship and then doing the Rage Party.
Did you guys have like a loop ahead of time, like a house show loop, or was you just like here kind of for a couple days leading up? Cause I know nowadays they don't really have house shows leading up, obviously. They're just here for the whole week and they just kind of hang out.
I would have to research that on historyofwwf.com, but I think we did that that week's TVs. You know, we did that Raw, and I think we went home. I don't think we had any house shows leading up to that. I could be wrong. I'm sure somebody will fact check me. But just going from memory, I believe we did that week's the go home episodes of Raw leading up to WrestleMania, and then we all went home. It might have been different for me because I lived in Philly. Other talent from other cities might have had to come to Philly early. So maybe that's where I'm kind of losing the plot on that one because I just went home.
Yeah, home is Philly, where WrestleMania is.
I'm sure other talent had to come to Philly to do press and stuff like that. But for me, it was just like being home, which was like the cool part, sleeping in. You know, I did WrestleMania and I'm sleeping in my own bed at the night. You know, it's kind of cool.
But now we got to talk about this Rage Party because we watched it. We did a deep dive on it.
Yeah.
That was one of our very first ones, too. It left the mark.
Yeah. And since we have me and you on talk about WrestleMania 15, we got to talk about the Rage Party.
Yeah.
Were you at the Rage Party? I'm assuming you were.
Yeah. Yes.
At the convention center.
Yes.
What was the mood like? Because it looked like on TV, it was just like a bunch of guys in the convention center just hanging out in the middle of the convention center, and there'll be some wrestling stuff happening at the same time, like a promo, Vince McMahon dancing, Isaac Hayes. But like all this stuff is happening, but it's just a bunch of people standing, hanging out in the convention center, trying to take me backstage or take me just what the hell was this party? Brian.
I wish I could give you something exciting about it. It's like there was the big room with the convention and everything like that. It took up like a good portion of the convention center, and then there was like a green room in the back for the boys just to hang out. And it was kind of surreal because that night I met Zach Wild from Ozzy Osbourne Band, who was hanging out because he's a big wrestling fan, and he brought the guys from his band Black Label Society just to hang out. He wasn't even performing. He was just there hanging out. Right. Well, he was friends with security guy Jim Dotson.
Is that the real guy?
Yeah, the real muscular guy who was always at ringside. He was the head of security for WWE. And yeah, he was Jim Dotson was a huge metalhead. And Zach, being from Jersey, being local, he invited Zach out. And Zach was hanging out in the back with the boys just watching, and there's a monitor and there was catering, which is like, that's the joke. Like if you're not booked, you're hanging out catering.
Yeah.
You go to my Pro Wrestling Tees, I have a t-shirt for unbooked catering. It says, we have something for you when creative doesn't, you know?
I like that.
Yeah. That night I learned a lot about pesto sauce. Big Show's eating this big plate of pasta. I'm like, what's that green stuff? He goes, oh, it's pesto. I was like, oh, let me try it. You know, four plates later, you know, I was like, whatever. And I was slated to be on that rage party. This is how competitive the, you know, WWE was at the time, you know, especially dealing with live TV. You could be slated to be on the show and last second to go, okay, your segment's cut. Because there was a moment where me and Goldust and Ryan Shamrock were in the middle of the floor at the rage party with a camera crew and everything. And we're waiting to come back from commercial, and the fans are watching us. And I'm just standing there like waiting to go in the meanie mode. I was supposed to do like a sort of like a lap dance for Goldust to win his attention over Ryan Shamrock.
What?
Yeah, like Ryan Shamrock was going to be like, you know, playing with his hair, massaging him. I was supposed to, you know, dance like I'm trying to win his affection and stuff like that. And then, like, right as we're right, I'm like, you know, when you see somebody running a race during the go position at the starting blocks, I'm like in the starting blocks. And then the producer goes, the segment got cut. We're like, crap. So we have to just like turn off the lights and walk off. And I guess maybe the good part about that, the good part that came out of that is we're walking along and I'm walking side by side, turning to my right, and there's Isaac Hayes. I was like, oh, hey, hey. And he shook his hand and that was about it. I was like, son of a bitch, my camera's in my gear bag. I would have got a photo with Isaac Hayes, but
man,
it was an interesting show. You know, I just remember hanging out in catering and watching most of it from catering and, you know, watching some of the bands play. You know, so there's a couple bands that were good. You know, then there you had your one hit wonders like there's a band, Big Mouth or something.
It was Cherry Poppin' Daddies was there.
And there was another band. Their album cover was somebody had the American flag tattooed on their tongue. I'm trying to think of that band.
Ooh.
They had a song. I think that had a song remember. In Varsity Blues or something like that. I'm going back to that.
I remembered it. Yeah, I remember that? Isaac Hayes performed Big Pun and Cherry Poppin' Daddies. So that's all I remember as far as musical acts. I guess there were more, but I don't remember. Do you remember, Nick?
No, I just remember the Cherry Poppin' Daddies was like the band, so that's all I remember.
I think these guys were the Dark Match.
I was going to ask you.
There's festivities off air as well.
Yeah, I was going to ask you how long was that party? Was it an all day thing or like
pretty much a I know I wouldn't say all day. It was pretty much an all night thing.
Yeah,
well, not like
because it was only like on TV after hours,
but you know, it was long enough for them to make money off concessions, which justified renting out the convention center for a night. You know, so they had a bar and stuff like that, and guys were getting lit up and having some daddy sodas and stuff nice. Like that. So yeah, it was crazy on TV for whoever it was on TV. It was fun off air too, you know.
I think in my head I had, because I was a big fan of Shock on Saturday Night, even though I couldn't watch it live. So yeah. In my head going into that, I was like, this is gonna be just like Shock on Saturday Night 2 years ago. I was like, maybe they'll have a ring there and they'll have matches, and I was excited, but I taped it anyway and I was like, oh, this is okay. I didn't really watch it after the fact until we did our deep dive.
The crazy thing is when I was only 10 when it aired, and I'm like, I want to be there. Like, it looked like the coolest party in history on TV.
Yeah.
Now, in hindsight, it probably wasn't the coolest party in history. But as a kid, you're like, man, all those people, they're just having fun and living life. And there's Stone Cold and there's DX. And
it's like Philly, you know?
Right.
I grew up in Atlantic City, and I still might kick myself for not going to the Slammies. You know, the Slammies were literally three blocks from my house where I lived in Atlantic City. And I wish I would have just went and watched them, you know, record the guys pulling up to the building and stuff like that. You know, you know, you show guys showing up in ambulances and limousines and stuff like that. You know, I was three blocks from that. And then for whatever mental block I had, I didn't leave my house to go even look or try to get in, because I was pretty good at sneaking into stuff, you know, as a kid. You know, I snuck, me and my buddies from high school snuck into the Holyfield Foreman fight.
Nice.
Yeah, which was. Like a scene out of a movie, you know. I know we're talking about WrestleMania, but like that, we were like, man, let's try to get in there. And it's one of those doors where one side had the push bar, and the outside door was just flat, but we stuck our fingertips in on each side of the door. Five guys this side, five guys that, 3, 2, 1, and we pulled, and the door flew open. We went, holy shit, it worked. And security went, hey, get out of here. And we just scattered cockroaches. I was like, they can't catch us all. No. And then we reconvened at the top and watched the fight for free in the nosebleeds. It was pretty cool. But
That's dope.
I kicked myself for not going to down to see the Slammy. So when you said, you know, you wish you were at the Rage party, it just brought me back to that time, you know, where, you know, I was a young kid, you know, trying to MacGyver my way into situations.
It's funny because that same event, WrestleMania, I obviously didn't have tickets. I didn't go, but I wanted to watch it on pay-per-view. And I don't think my mom knew how big of a wrestling fan I was just yet. So when, like, you probably seen this back in the day, the pay-per-view will start and you have that little like 10-minute preview and then it shuts off because you didn't pay for it, obviously. Right. That was me. So I'm sitting there watching. I'm like, maybe I get to watch it for free. And then it shut off. I was like, no. I started crying, man. I was like 10. I was crying that I didn't get to watch WrestleMania 15.
Oh. Back in the day, on the cable remote, there was this button that said A/B. You know, if you kept hitting that, you can listen to the scrambled pay-per-view, you know?
Oh, yeah. We've done that a couple times back in the day.
That was me with the Spice Channel. You
know? There was the meme where it was like, oh, I see a nipple or something like that. And it's just like the
scramble. It was green, but it was a nipple. That counts.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, it's funny you guys talk about that. I didn't want to go to WrestleMania because I was like the biggest wrestling fan. I was the only wrestling fan when I moved to Jersey and I was in my school, and then I got really popular. So people were like talking to me about it here and there, but they liked, you know, The Rock and Austin, like the big guys. They didn't care about like the middle card or the mid card or, you know, the opening match or whatever. So I was just kind of like, well, they're not real wrestling fans, so I don't want to like associate with them. Like, I was a snob, you know, like I was a wrestling snob. I was like, I'm the real fan here. And I knew, like, I just had a feeling that so many of my classmates were going to be at WrestleMania, even though I haven't talked to them about it. So I was like, I don't want to go. Like, I'd rather just watch it at home in my safe area with my parents. Like, that's where I'm most comfortable. Like, I don't want to be in that crowd. I never went to an ECW show. I have friends that went to a lot of ECW shows in the ECW arena. And I remember I went to a Combat Zone wrestling show in 2011. And I was just like, wow, this crowd is so different than what I'm used to when I go to like a WWF show. And I just wasn't a fan of it. Like, I had a certain comfortability of what crowd I wanted to be around. Attitude Era WWF wasn't that. You know, I went to a Raw in 98 and I was like, I don't like being around here. I miss the new generation of 1995 with like Diesel and whatnot and Jeff Jarrett and everything. Like, that that's where I felt comfortable, you know, not in an Attitude Era crowd. So, yeah, I was happy just to watch WrestleMania from Philly at home. And when I lived, you know, 20 minutes away.
Dude, you just described my life at 47, where I really just don't want to leave the house.
I'm with you.
You know, back in the day, sending me to my room was a punishment. Now it's a reward. Just, go to my room. Oh, yeah.
You ain't got to tell me.
Yeah.
I was going there anyway.
Yeah. You know, it wasn't a punishment as a kid, because I had a TV, I had a fridge, I had everything. I had like the coolest bedroom as a teenager, you know, just... I took whatever furniture other relatives didn't want. You know, I had a full couch with a pull-out bed and a TV and a fridge and a stuff.
Yeah, Hey Arnold for them, pretty much.
Yeah, I had a perfect bachelor pad for a teenager, you know.
So let's get to the show now. Yeah. And let's provide some context a little bit, because the context is that WWF at this point was crushing things, everything, attendance, ratings. I mean, everything is flying off the shelves. Merchandise, everything is selling. It's a hot product on TV. Meaning you're right in the thick of it. So, you know, obviously you were ECW in its heyday, but what was it like being with WWF at that point in time when Steve Austin's at his peak, The Rock is at his peak? I mean, we're not even into probably the best part of the Attitude Era. I think the best part was 2000 when they had like Edge and Christian and the tag teams and all that stuff. But what was it like for you being a part of a product that high at that level too?
Dude, I was very fortunate. You know, I was part of ECW during their hottest period from like 96 to 98. And then, you know, it seemed like happenstance where I get the call to go to WWE in 98 to 2000, you know, which in some ways was the hottest era. it's all a matter of opinion and taste and stuff like that. There's no wrong answer. Whatever makes you happy, you know, is what I say. But it was very cool, man. You know, they're doing TV in ECW where a lot of it's, you record it and they, edit it in post. And then, we start doing live TVs around, Barely Legal. And that's when we start getting, taste of doing live TV. And when we did ECW Invaded Raw. But then you go to WWE and there's that pressure every week of live TV. Well, at that point, we'd do a live Monday Night Raw. And then on Tuesday, we would do the following week's Raw. Right, and then eventually, the pressure became to do, Eric Bischoff put the pressure on, give him all the credit, he's given away WWE's, the match, the wins and losses, the finishes on Monday Nitro. Okay. This week they're taped, so the pressure became to do live every week. So that pressure of just doing live TV every week, I hear stories about how back in the day when people used to, work on Saturday Night Live and they're working hard to get their bit on air. You know what I'm saying? When you're there in that era, you're working hard just to get a match on Raw.
Right.
Now, sometimes you get, relegated to like a Heat or a Metal, or something like that, which is fine. Nope. And not knocking anything, but as a performer, you want to be on that live Raw, because, 10 seconds on a Raw, your life changes. I remember going to WWE. I would go to Walmart down there on Delaware Ave. And I'm like, are people following me?
Wow.
I would get for ECW, I would get noticed, out in the wild. And then, you're walking through Walmart and you have that sixth sense of where you feel like you're being followed or watched. Some people call it paranoia, but you're walking down an aisle and you're side-eyeing. And then you stop and the person down at the other end of the aisle who's going down that aisle stops and you start walking, they start walking kind of thing. It's just man, WWE's TV's got some reach. Cause I live here and I was on TV every week in Philly and none of this stuff happened. Kids are knocking at your door, asking for stuff like that, which I'm not complaining. A lot of those kids wound up becoming adults and, I meet them out in the wild and they remind me about that. So it's all cool. But yeah, being WWE in that era, my God, the fact that I'm still here in 2021 talking to y'all about, things I did in WWE with WrestleMania 15. I mean, it had staying power. I went and watched that. Like I said, I wanted to prep myself for this and rewatch WrestleMania 15. And I mean, they did a lot of hot shotting in that era too, because of the pressure of live TV and having direct competition, now they, and when TV was really a war between WWE and WCW, now they try to do the whole Wednesday night wars, but with NXT and AEW, I was like, can't really be a war if you're fighting over decimal points, Seriously, back in the day, Raw and Nitro, they were doing 8-point whatevers, 9-point whatevers, and now it's you're fighting over 0.05 whatever, calculus you want to, whatever.
We got the scientific derivative.
It's not a war. That's my soapbox. But back in the day when it was a real war and you felt real pressure to not only beat the competition, but pressure as yourself as a performer to get that airtime, because this is the moneymaker right here. I know we're on audio, but I'm making a square around my face for my co-host here. This is the moneymaker, your face. You want that on that Monday Night Raw. So long story short on your answer, or short story long story short, whichever you prefer. Yeah, there's a lot of pressure, man, to get on that live TV.
Speaking of pressure, let's go to March 28th, 1999. This is, you talk about pressure, this is it. This is WrestleMania, the biggest show of the year.
Yeah.
Not just from a, storyline standpoint, but from a financial standpoint. A lot of you guys, that's at least back in the day with the old pay-per-view model, the majority of your pay for that year probably came from WrestleMania. So you got to show up, you got to show out.
I'm sorry. It's funny you say that, but I know I'm jumping ahead, but like before I got there, I always heard stories of, man, you want that WrestleMania payoff. Right. And then, for those who don't know, you get your weekly, I had a weekly downside guarantee. If I went to TV, I got X amount. If I went to a pay-per-view, I got X amount. Now, if I'm on a paper, if I go to a house show, I get X amount. I could get a draw from that week's, a cash advance. And then a couple months later, you get your house show money. If you work a pay-per-view, at least back then, I don't know how it is now with the network. Back then, if you worked a pay-per-view, you could get your a cash advance against your check. And then a couple months later, maybe 3 months later, you get your pay-per-view check. So we work WrestleMania, and back in the AOL days, you're on AIM, and I'm talking to a couple of different coworkers. They're like, "Did you get your check?" "Yeah, I got my check." And like the check was just like a regular house show payoff.
Oh.
And like you're thinking, man, because going to WWE, you're like, dude, you hear stories about guys getting their pay-per-view check and it's like a down payment on a house,
Right. Especially the WrestleMania check, like you said, it's like, oh, that made my year. Like,
a lot
of people, all the stories.
Yeah, you're thinking, five figures, And you're like, you're like, dude, I got my WrestleMania check. I thought it was like a Madison Square Garden check, which it was nothing to sneeze at either. But at that time, they're saying it's the highest rated the biggest buy rate for any WWE pay-per-view at that point. And then you get to your check and you're like, oh, I guess I went to the, I guess I went to the main event. I don't know.
Yeah. That was a rage party check.
Yeah, I got a rage party check. Dude, if I had 2020 hindsight back in the day, I could have said that to whoever I was chatting to on Instant Messenger with. Is this a rage party check? What the hell?
Yeah, I think you think Austin and Rock for the house, but it's like, damn, they took all the money too, apparently.
Nah. Hey, they deserve every penny, man. They were
the of course. Yeah.
Dude, like I said, for all I went through, like me walking through Walmart and getting followed, I watched them walk through an airport and oh my God. And this is like pre-9/11. This is like pre-9/11 where anybody could go through the security and sit at a gate and wait for you with a stack of 800 8x10s hoping you sign them and stuff like that. It's crazy. What those guys went through and the pressure they went through. So I
felt awkward going to a mall and standing in line just to beat them. And I can't imagine how it'd be like an airport. Yeah, exactly. Like I felt awkward just because I'm like, I feel like I'm bothering them even though they're there for that,
But they're at the mall for a reason. But when you're going to an airport to fly home and there's a guy at the airport with a stack of 8x10s, hey, can you sign these? I was like, I'll sign one of them.
Right.
And then they go away and they, send over a kid with the stack of 8x10s. Say, he's not going to turn down a kid, is he?
Oh, yeah.
It's just apparently that kind of thing still goes on to this day, which.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Even in COVID, there's still people trying to get in airports and get autographs. Even at NovaCare with the Eagles, where we, our headquarters, people, non-COVID times, people will wait outside the gates and wait for people to pull out, and try to see who's in the car. Like, oh, can I get autographs, sign the helmet, whatever. So, yeah, people are hectic when it comes to those autographs. I mean, they don't play games. Yeah. I guess that resale market, I guess it's maybe it's worth it. Maybe get the right autograph, the right signature, and somebody's willing to buy it.
Yeah,
you can come up, but I don't know if it's worth it all the time when you're bothering people in the airports.
Yeah.
At maybe 2 o'clock in the morning at the end of a loop maybe, and they're dead tired,
Yeah, and you get people at the worst time. They just woke up. They don't want to be going to the airport.
Right.
You just want to be in your own bed. And hey, can you sign 8,000 8x10s for me? Especially if you're late for your flight and stuff like that. And then, if you blow him off, oh, he was so mean to me.
Exactly.
Craziness.
Exactly. So let's go to the start of WrestleMania 15. We got Boyz II Men, the Philly natives, Boyz II Men singing America the Beautiful. Most of the catalog is still a bop to this day. Obviously, I'm sure we all know multiple songs. My personal favorite is Motown Philly.
Yes.
Back again. You know what I'm saying? That's still a bop to this day.
I still shed a tear for End of the Road, you know.
Exactly. You know, that's...
I got to meet those guys backstage, and very cool. Very cool dudes, but I was just blown away by how much taller I was than them. Because you grow up watching people on TV, you're like, you think the tallest guy's like, oh, he's got to be 7 foot. And I'm like taller than the tallest guy. I was like, oh, son of a bitch. TV fooled me. And then like now I was watching it the other day, you know, leading up to this. And now I gauge how tall somebody is, depending on how close they are to the top rope.
Yeah. The further away they are, the taller they may look, right?
I was like, the top rope comes up to my shoulder blades, so I'm gauging. I was like, it's up to his, you know, chin. So he's a little bit shorter, you know.
Yeah.
It's goofy how I gauge things, you know, nowadays. But yeah, those guys are great, and what a way to open up the pay per view with the hometown talent, and it's fantastic.
Right. They did a great job. And go ahead, Nick.
No, I was going to say no single piece of WWF merchandise, you know, the way Willie Nelson had it, like WrestleMania 7. You know, that's how I gauge, you know, are they really like into it? Like, a Boys and Men just here? Like, do they really like WWF? Like, I don't know.
I did take note of their fashion because we had, like, I put the fashion of 1999 was on full display. We had one wearing a turtleneck, another one wearing a sleeveless leather vest, and another one had like a bandana around his head. It was just like, This is fashion in 1999. You look at Boys to Men; they were all like, they could have went straight from WrestleMania straight to the club. But when you look at it in hindsight, it's like, what the hell? A sleeveless leather vest, really? Steve Austin now?
That's probably his vest.
Yeah, the pre-Rock Hollywood leather vest going on there when he did the Rock concert.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So then we transition to a video package voiced by Classy Freddie Blassie, which I thought was actually very well done.
Emotional when I hear his voice.
He has a very, like, that gravity, like, very, I guess I'm going to call it baritone. It's just very deep and gravity. It sounds very, like I said, I guess emotional or, like, regal. It was dope, though.
Yeah. Love it. Love it.
So shout out to Classy Freddie Blassie. We get the big power display. And we got Michael Cole and Jerry Lawler on the call. And we got Michael Cole calling The Rock versus Steve Austin the most anticipated match in the history of WWF. Now, obviously, these are the two top guys in the game at this point. And they're on the Mount, pretty much everybody's Mount Rushmore. It's one or both of these guys.
Yeah.
But was it actually more anticipated than Hogan Andre or Hogan Warrior? I'm just asking because I'm like, as much as this match was anticipated, and WWF was on the money train at this point, like they were white hot. Everywhere they went was sold out.
Yeah.
Was it more anticipated than Hogan Warrior or Hogan Andre?
You could say Hogan Andre because they filled a stadium, but
both of them did. Hogan Warrior did Sky Dome too.
Yeah. But I think in a sense that both talent wound up coming up together. Like Hogan Andre, even before WrestleMania 3, they had a series of matches, you know, where, you know, Hogan was the heel and Andre was the baby faces, even though WWE didn't, you know, present that in the build up. But like you talk about two talents who came to WWE relatively around the same time and they ascended the ladder pretty much together. You know, at the same time, Andre was always Andre. He was always the draw, you know, and then, you know, Hogan became Hulkamania and they were kind of baby faces at the same time. But for, you know, The Rock to ascend, they pretty much, and a lot of people leave Triple H out too, because Triple H and The Rock kind of came up that ladder, ascended that ladder
together
as well. But, you know, the path they took for this WrestleMania was Rock and Austin. I think it was, you know, well anticipated just for the fact that these two guys, you know, I'm repeating myself, but they ascended that ladder and they were meeting at the, you know, essentially the Super Bowl of professional wrestling. And of course, you know, they say that's the most anticipated wrestling match until the next year, you know,
of course.
And, Yeah, they got to sell somehow. I remember the first WrestleMania, they were like, come see WrestleMania live because you'll be old and gray by the time these tapes are seen again. And then 3 months later, they're selling the VHS. It's like, ah. That's when I learned wrestling will lie to you. You know, wrestling business will lie.
But, it's definitely part of the sell, but I just wanted to examine. I always wanted to examine stuff like that. Like, was it in actuality, really, was it? Or is just another time that they're going to, like, for the first time ever, or the biggest match ever, or something like that, with Tony Schiavone, the most anticipated, the biggest night in the history of our sport type of thing. So,
yeah, those guys were scorching hot.
Of course, no doubt.
You know, in that era, live TV every week and ratings battles, and you're dealing with, battling WCW in the peripheral and stuff like that. Yeah, it's pretty anticipated. The fact that this was part one of a WrestleMania trilogy, you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no doubt. First match on the show, though. After we get Michael Cole and Jerry Lawler's introduction, opening match is for the WWF Hardcore Championship Triple Threat match. We got Hardcore Holly, Billy Gunn, and the man that trained you, Blue Meanie, and Al Snow, all the way in Lima, Ohio. Talk about how much Al Snow's meant to you. I know you had a post on social media not that long ago about the big start of your career and how much Al Snow's meant to your career. Talk about him a little bit and how much he's meant to you.
Oh, Al Snow's my big brother. Even to this day, you know, a lot of times when you go to train in any line of work, it's so easy for somebody to just take your money and not show you anything. And you know back in the day, people would train you and they would try to make you quit, you know, and you know, they'd, you know, beat you up, take your money, and out the door you go and on to the next. But when I was training with Al, I mean, he was meticulous in not only how he trained, but you know, made you understand why it was hard. And you know, he made me believe in myself. You know, there's a lot of times I wanted to quit and I would roll out a ring and be like, oh, can't do this. And he would be like, you know, all right, calm down, take a breath. And he'd just talk to you and get you back in the ring and teach you what you need to be, taught. So it was very, very cool. You know, and, you know, eventually, you know, I was with Al for a year and then he said, you know, hey, it's time for you to go out into the world on your own and learn how to hustle. And I got my way into ECW. And then Al comes to ECW. Then Al goes to WWE. And then eventually I go to WWE. And Al's my gateway into WWE through the Job Squad. So he's always been a huge part of my life in and out of the ring. And, you know, this was his first WrestleMania match, which
it was.
Yeah, it blew my mind that he hadn't had a WrestleMania match, but to this point, but he was like one of those centerpieces around that hardcore title, you know, the hardcore title, which now they kind of brought back in the 24/7 title where, you know, people were fighting all over the world and stuff like that. But, yeah, that hardcore title's still over, man. To this day, people still talk about those hardcore title moments, and to have it kick off WrestleMania was pretty cool because, you know, you always want to start off the show hot. You know, any show, the most important matches are the opening match and the last match, and everything else is peaks and valleys. But you want to start off the show hot, set the tone, and then, you know, peaks and valleys, bring them up, bring them down, bring them up, bring them down, and then leading into the main event when everybody's caught their breath, that's where you wear them out for the grand finale, you know, so to speak, with any show. So the fact that they open up with a hardcore match reminds me of, you know, years to come when they would open almost every WrestleMania with a TLC, Money in the Bank match. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Following WrestleMania, sometimes the most exciting match would be that opening Money in the Bank match. You know, it set the tone for the night. You know, something big was going to happen. So, you know, opening up with a hardcore match made sense because you're going to start off the show hot. And Billy Gunn, you know, was the champion at the time, which was unique. I think of hardcore.
That's one word for it.
I don't really think of Billy Gunn as hardcore, but Hardcore Holly fit into that role quite well, I think. You know, Bob Holly found his niche with that hardcore division. Anyway, I popped a little bit because he came out in like black trunks and black tights. And it's like, you know, everybody's known for getting their, you know, the WrestleMania gear, you know.
He did not.
he did not get his WrestleMania gear on. He just had black boots, black tights. I don't know what happened with that, but
look, he spent years as Thurman Sparky Plug. He's like, I'm not here for the bells and whistles anymore. I'm trying to be straightforward now. I'm tired of being the NASCAR guy and the whole bells and whistles with the gear and all that stuff. I'm just being hardcore.
He was Bodacious Bob.
Could
have stuck with that.
Hollywood Bob too.
Damn. Here's
Hollywood Bob Holly and Smoky Mountain. But Bob, man, yeah, he made a niche for himself with that. That was a good venue, good avenue for him to break out. He broke it, you know, like I said, they split up the job squad, and Bob, you know, he found a niche with that hardcore, you know, the title, and became a name and a competitor on the roster, where, you know, before he was a little bit lost in the shuffle, but now he had a reason, you know, on the card and stuff like that, you know, with the hardcore championship and those, a lot of those memorable matches.
And on this night, he won the hardcore championship for the second time. Yeah. I wrote that he probably won it 20 more times. Who knows with the 24/7 rule.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was a good opener for, at least at this point. In hindsight, it's odd to see the hardcore championship being the opener. Cause you might see Money in the Bank, or you might see like a big match with like maybe a 1-on-1. It's exciting. And it's like, oh, the hardcore championship. And like I said, Billy Gunn is the hardcore champion. Like when I think hardcore champions, I don't think Billy Gunn is the one that comes to mind. But
Billy Gunn, great performer.
Oh yeah.
But hardcore division, you know.
Right.
I always look at that hardcore title as the ECW title, you know, in WWF. And I would get angry. I would get legitimately angry when somebody like a Billy Gunn or even Hardcore Holly, before he really cemented himself as a mainstay in the hardcore division, I didn't view him as like a hardcore guy at this time as a fan. So when I think Al Snow beat him at St. Valentine's Day Massacre, when we did the deep dive on that, and I was like, yes, that feels right. Because to me, Al Snow was an ECW guy. Like, he wasn't Leap Cassidy. Like, I didn't remember him as that. It was the ECW crowd that made Al Snow for me. You know, he main evented WrestlePalooza against Shane Douglas. And even though he lost, like, he was an ECW guy to me. So it felt right for him to be, like, hardcore champion. Or anyone else from ECW that I watched at ECW. So when it was somebody else, I was just like, no, that doesn't make sense. I don't like it.
Yeah, I mean, Al was originally, he was penciled in to be ECW champion at WrestlePalooza, but back and forth behind the scenes stuff, nothing too harsh.
And that's crazy, because Shane Douglas, wasn't he like so beat up? He had like a million injuries at the time, and they kept the belt on him.
Yeah, we told Al he basically lost to a slot machine because, you know, Shane Douglas only had one arm, you know? You know, it would have been perfect just to, you know, put the belt on Al and this, you know, have Shane go heal up for a little bit, you know, but, Al was supposed to be the ECW champion that night, but you know, backstage stuff works out. Not in horror, but just like, you know, volleying back.
He was in the WWF a few months later, right?
Yeah, pretty much. So, you know, it didn't really hurt Al, you know, because he went back to WWE. But you know, it would have been cool to see Al get the ECW belt because he was one of the hottest acts at ECW at around that time.
Right. Maybe do you think they knew, and maybe they was like, let's hold off on giving him the belt because he's probably on his way out.
That could have been a factor too.
Maybe
that could have been a factor too. But like, you know, you hear stories and stuff like that. And
right. He said that type of stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. But moving on from
very Games of Thrones without all the murder, you know.
Some blood and guts, but no murder.
Yeah.
No murder.
You know, and in this hardcore match, we had a Let's Go Flyers chant. Al Snow grabbed the hockey stick, so there you go.
So Flyers.
That was the first year, by the way, I watched the Flyers, you know, every day, so, or every game. So I was a big Flyers fan at that point. So I was like, yeah. Of course.
First Union Center, home of the Flyers and the Sixers. It's 25th year of that building, by the way, of the Wells Fargo Center. First started out, it was Core State Center.
Yeah.
Then First Union, then Wachovia, and then now Wells Fargo. So, yeah. 25 years of that building. That's gone by fast.
Wow. I went to the very first public event there, which was Oasis. Oasis was the first event there. They had a private event just for employees and stuff like that, I believe. They had a private concert for just employees and staff. But the first one where they allowed fans into the building was Oasis with Screaming Trees opening up and went to that concert. So that was pretty cool.
And it's like, somehow that building's had, it's going by so fast, but that building's had a lot of mainstay. And it's not going anywhere anytime soon. It's more like they just renovated it, like maybe in 2019 into 2020 or something like that. So I don't know, last time you guys were there.
Yeah, when that building was, when it was first built and it was Core State Center, people used to call it this, a lot of locals would call it Spectrum 2. It was weird.
Yeah, I remember seeing that. Yeah, like in newspapers and stuff like that. Spectrum 2.
Yeah, a lot of old heads would be like, Spectrum 2. I'm going to Spectrum 2 to see the Flyers or Sixers. It's like, well, it's Core State Center. But, all right.
it's Spectrum 1 now. The Spectrum is gone. It's been gone for a long time, too.
Yep.
It's crazy to think that some people today don't even know what the Spectrum, they've never even been inside it, don't even remember it being there. Because remember, for a long time, it was still there while the Wells Fargo Center was still up. They had both buildings.
Yeah.
Where Xfinity Live is now, it's where the Spectrum was, I believe.
Yep. Dude, I just had a memory, and you just jarred a memory. The Friday before WrestleMania.
Okay.
Myself, the Headbangers, Paul Bearer, Al Snow, and Al Snow's family went to a Philadelphia Fandoms game at the Spectrum.
Nice. What a crew, by the way. You said you, the Headbangers, mm-hmm. Paul Bearer, and Al Snow, and Paul Bearer's family?
You just jarred a memory out of my thick skull. Like, oh, what did you do during the week? I was like, oh, I don't know. Friday night, me, Al's wife, his kids, and the Headbangers and Paul Bearer went separately, but we just were like, oh, you're here too? So we just all sat together. I have a friend who's the equipment manager he's with the Flyers now, but he was the equipment manager for the Philadelphia Phantoms. It's Philadelphia Phantoms against the Hershey Bears.
Nice.
That's like the Austin Rock for the AHL.
Pretty much. Because like they're like anytime somebody on the Philadelphia Phantoms would like do something or get into a fight, they would play like a WWE theme. There's like a fight, and somebody would hit like I went to a couple Phantoms games that year. One guy got into a fight, and they would hit the Rock's music, and he would just stand and do the Rock thing. And put out each, you know? So here's a funny story from that. I wish I could remember the guy's name, but. You know, me, Paul Bearer, the Headbangers, Al, and his family are sitting there in our seats. And I guess somebody smartened up the guys on the team that we were there. So one guy from the Philadelphia Phantoms just beats the shit out of somebody from the Hershey Bears. And to the point where he's hitting the guy, and the guy's just turtling up. He gave up, and he's still on top. It's like a UFC fight. Boom, 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 boom. He's like, yeah, well. Years later, maybe a year, 2 years later, I went to see this band called Bonehead, a local cover band, play over at the Pennant East in New Jersey. And that same player from the Philadelphia Phantoms was there to see Bonehead. And he's like, oh, yeah, I remember you guys came out and we were all excited. You were in the crowd. And he's like, I was in a situation. Normally, I wouldn't have gotten into a fight, but I knew you guys were in the crowd, so I knew I had to do something. And he purposely had to fight and beat the shit out of the guy just because he knew like the WWE guys were in the crowd.
I love how he called it a situation. Like, we all saw it happen. We all saw you fight this guy.
Yeah. He's like, normally I wouldn't have got hot, but I knew you guys were in the crowd. I knew I had to do something. You know?
Awesome. I found myself in this predicament, you see.
Yeah. Yeah. And then they hit Stone Cold's music or something after the fight or something like that.
Nice.
So that was pretty cool.
That's pretty wild. At a Phantoms game.
Yeah, two nights before WrestleMania.
And then WrestleMania rage party one day before.
Yeah.
Hey, that was the real rage party.
Yeah.
Forget the convention center. It was more raging at the Phantoms game.
Yeah, man.
Than the convention center. But moving on to the second match of the night. Got the WWF tag team titles being defended. Owen Hart and Jeff Jarrett defending against D'Lo Brown and Test. Now, D'Lo Brown and Test got this title match, not because they were like some established tag team, because of course you're like, why the hell were they a tag team? It's like, no, they weren't. They were just the last two people that won a battle royal on like Heat before WrestleMania. And they were fighting each other at the end of this battle royal. It's like, no, you won. You guys got to stop fighting each other now. Like, yeah. You got a match. You got a match in like maybe an hour. Like, stop fighting each other.
Yeah.
So they go up against Owen Hart and Jeff Jarrett. And I wrote, it's a shame. I think I've talked about this before on the podcast, that Jeff Jarrett and Owen Hart, they were a tag team, but they weren't together too long because, of course, Owen Hart unfortunately passed away in May. But I thought they were actually really good together. And I thought we would have known, like, we would recognize them as a more prominent tag team if, of course, Owen Hart hadn't passed away. And I think they might have split up even before that. I'm not totally sure. But yeah, they were actually pretty good together.
Yeah. I think they were split, but they were still kind of joined a little bit when that happened.
Well, it's kind of like at that moment, DX was still together, but the New Age Outlaws, Billy Gunn had the Hardcore title, Road Dogg had the Intercontinental title. They weren't totally split up, but they were on different paths at that
point.
But Owen Hart and Jeff Jarrett were really a good team that complemented each other really well. And it also had to do, besides the fact they were great workers, but they had a really deep relationship off camera as well. Both being family men, both great fathers to their children and stuff like that. So they had a bond, off camera, which wound up, working its way onto camera too, where they were both heels, but you could tell they had great chemistry.
Yeah, I agree. I thought it's kind of like, I was watching, I think we watched St. Valentine's Day Massacre, and then we watched WrestleMania. It's like, damn, Owen Hart and Jeff Jarrett, they were pretty good together. Like, and you don't think of Jeff Jarrett as more of as a tag team guy. I've always remembered him as a single. And Owen Hart, he's had multiple tag teams, but he was always good. And Owen Hart's one of the greatest of all time, in my opinion. But him and Jeff Jarrett together, I thought really worked. And I wish they got a longer run together. But this match was a match. I mean, we got Test's WrestleMania debut. I did not know he was a bodyguard for Motley Crue. But when you look at him, it makes sense. He's a big jacked up dude.
Yeah.
I wouldn't want to be messing with him at all.
I think that was just storyline. Bodyguard for Motley Crue. That was the storyline. That's how he did.
Because didn't Motley Crue have an appearance on Raw?
Yeah.
And,
yeah. So they play, and that's how they test. He wasn't a shoot bodyguard for Motley Crue, but the storyline, that's how they debuted him. He's from Canada. He trained in the I want to say he trained with the Hearts. Test no longer with us. Total sweetheart of a guy. I mean, it's a shame. Two guys, Owen and Test are no longer with us. But since we're talking about Test, everybody knows about Owen Hart, but Test, total sweetheart of a guy. He had a good run the first time around. I think he had an even better run the second time around when he came back with the short hair and it was this monster. But I always got along with him. I had a match with him, around 2002, maybe 2003. The 8-man tag together for a wrestle reunion, and so good in the ring, timing and everything. And to the point where we got along so well, like, he was in town for Wizard World in Philly. I would stop by to say hey, and he was doing an independent show. And he was thinking about telling the guys to, to book me so he could just work me on the show and stuff like that. He's like, I don't know what I'm doing on the show. Maybe I'll just have them, have me against you or something like that. But I was like, yeah, that's cool. Didn't happen, but it was nice of him to say that to me, But he's going way too soon. Everybody, again, Owen was in this match. Owen passed away. Everybody loves Owen. Everybody knows Owen. But Test was a really good dude, man. He was a really good guy, sweetheart of a man. He looked like a monster, but deep down, he was a sweetheart.
Good guy. That's dope. Man. Here I am believing everything WWF tells me. He's a bodyguard for Motley Crue. Well, that must be true. they wouldn't just lie to me like that.
He looked
so Duke the Dumpster Jersey was really a garbage man.
Exactly.
They found him on the street, literally. Player.
Well, Boss Man really was like a prison guard. This is like back in the day when they, what do you do in real life? When they had no ideas, And
I'll tell you, that was one of the more creative ones. A bodyguard for Motley Crue. I was 15, not even 15 years old. And I'm like, oh, that's okay.
I'll take it.
I bought it. I definitely bought it. In this match, this was a quick, you know, nice match, well worked or whatever. It wasn't nothing crazy. Even though all four guys in the ring were great, and I don't have really anything bad to say about either any of the guys involved, especially my guy D'Lo Brown. You know, I love D'Lo Brown. One of the more underrated performers of his era, in my opinion. But it was a match, and Owen Hart and Jeff Hart, Jeff Jarrett, I should say, retained. Owen Hart and Jeff Hart, you know, their long lost Hart brother, Jeff Hart.
Yeah.
Right. But Owen Hart and Jeff Jarrett retained the tag titles because D'Lo Brown and Tess couldn't get along, and they're fighting with each other, and Ivory and Deborah are arguing with each other, and Terry Reynolds comes out. You know, she's with PMS. I think Jacqueline out there too. It was a lot going on.
Yeah, there was a lot going on. It's kind of, I hate to say it because there's so much talent in the ring, but it was kind of a throwaway match.
So to speak.
Yeah, I thought the same thing. I was like, it was kind of weird for WrestleMania, you know, to have that or see that on a WrestleMania, not even 4 minutes long, the match, and then, you know, just the weirdness going into it with Test and D'Lo, and then coming out of it, and it's just like, what is going on here? Like, it doesn't didn't feel like a WrestleMania type moment because I'm so used to WrestleMania finalizing everything, and I was like, I was so confused by it. So it was one of the first times I was really confused by a WrestleMania ending.
Yeah, it was, like you said, just a lot going on. I didn't get the finish at all, but like you said, so much talent involved too. Like Jacqueline, Miss Texas, like Hall of Famer, you know, Jeff Jarrett, Hall of Famer, Owen Hart. He's not technically in the WWE Hall of Fame yet, but he's a Hall of Fame. Yeah, he's a Hall of Fame. D'Lo Brown, I think it's worthy, you know, or the Nation of Domination as a group. Worthy.
Absolutely. Absolutely. D'Lo's a good dude, man. He's from the area. He's a right. boy. I first met him at the Monster Factory a week before I was driving out to train with Al Snow. You know, me and my buddies would go to Monster Factory and pay like $10 to, you know, roll around in a ring and do like backyard type wrestling and stuff like that. And him and Reckless Youth was there. Sorry for stay with the new mouth. and then like months later, I run into D'Lo. He goes through Smoky Mountain. He comes up and he becomes a trainer at Al Snow School after I had left. So me and D'Lo's paths have crossed a lot of time. But yeah, definitely he's a future Hall of Famer. Absolutely.
He ought to be. Like I said, if it's not just him alone as part of the Nation of Domination, let's do it.
Yeah, man.
Let's do it, because that was a dope group as well.
He was fucking over, you know?
He was over. I mean, people still doing the neck shake? Like, come on, now. Like, people still doing that.
And even the European title like thing, he's known for that still in 2021. Like, it's great. The chest protector, like, it's great.
He's from a different country in Europe every week?
Yeah.
Al Snow used to call D'Lo Johnny Bench because he wore a chest protector like in baseball.
and he had one of the dopest frog splashes of all time, too, that people don't talk about.
For his size, the stuff he was – because D'Lo's a tall dude, man. He's a big dude. And to do some of the cruiserweight style he could do at his height, it's so impressive. So impressive.
Yeah. So shout out to D'Lo Brown. Shout out to Tess. Shout out to everybody involved in this match. This match wasn't it, but everybody in this match, like you said, talented and worthy of, capable of more, but just wasn't allowed to do it at WrestleMania 15 for whatever reason.
Yeah.
But moving on, we got a lot to talk about here, Meanie. We got the Brawl for All. Man, oh man.
Yep.
For one, did you know Bart Gunn? What kind of guy was Bart Gunn? If you were familiar with him, if you got cross paths with him.
Yeah, Bart's a great guy. I really wasn't around him a lot in WWE, but for the times I was around him, he was always approachable, always respectful. You know, I was a dude on the roster, and you know, a lot of times when you're, like I said, you're trying to fight to get that TV time. You know, some guys aren't standoffish, but you know, they're trying to, you know, get theirs in. But he's always a good dude. I saw him years later at a convention at one of the Legends of the Ring in Central New Jersey. Still great guy, man. A great guy who got put in a tough situation.
Yeah.
Because the Brawl for All was designed to, you know, as a catalyst for Dr. Death Steve Williams. You know, Jim Ross famously said in the back, he's like, Well, you know, it's going to be Steve Rowe, with Steve Williams and everybody else fighting for second place. And and then, you know, unfortunately, Steve Williams blew out his knee. He blew his knee out. He tore his ACL or whatever. He couldn't continue, and Bart knocked him out. So everybody thought this was kind of like a receipt for Bart. That's the theory. I'm not saying
right.
The plan, but the theory is this might have been punishment for knocking out
Death. Even if it wasn't actually a punishment, this is just you're still leading a lamb to slaughter. And poor Bart Gunn.
Well, the theory, and another theory is, Bart might have had a chance if they didn't try to train him to be a boxer. Going into Brawl for All, you know, guys were just straight up fighting. To the point where, you know, when Bart Gunn went to fight Bob Holly in Brawl for All, they had a gentleman's agreement, no takedowns. You're going to knock me out. We're just going to punch each other until we knock each other out. Don't, because there was the rules. You can either win by, you know, knockout or takedowns and get points and stuff like that, which Dan Severn wound up doing to Mark Merrow. He just kept taking him down, getting points, you know. Right. So, you know, Bart Gunn and Bob Holly had that gentleman's agreement, no takedowns. And, you know, Bart was just knocking guys out because he was just using raw instinct. And I think the mistake they made was have him go into a gym with boxing people and take away his just natural instinct, stuff like that. Because Butterbean later on went to say, he's like, as soon as I saw him trying to be a boxer, I knew I had him. And there was a couple times, like before the knockout, where, you know, Bart Gunn was trying to stick to that boxing technique, and he made the mistake of, you know, turning around and turning his back to Butterbean, and Butterbean said that was another tell that he had Bart Gunn where he wanted him. He, you know, Bart Gunn was spinning around trying to stick to being a boxer and not a brawler. You know, if he would just stay, you know, just go in there, lift weights, hit a heavy bag, you know, get your reps in, throwing punches, and not be a boxer, I think he would have had a better chance. I think he still would have lost because, you know, Butterbean's, you know, been in the game longer. Mm-hmm. I think Bart Gunn could have definitely made it more interesting if they had just not put him in the gym with boxing people.
Yeah, I felt, like Bolin said, I felt kind of bad for Bart. I think it was the second season of Dark Side of the Ring. They covered the Brawl for All, and they had Bart on, and I watched that, and I feel so bad for him because, I mean, yeah, if I was in his position, I probably would feel like I was being, you know, because I won, that they were mad, and because their guy didn't win, and they were trying to just—it was like a receipt. So I definitely understand where he's coming from, but I didn't.
That whole event.
It's kind of interesting to me that they were, you know, they're like, okay, well, maybe you'd be better off suited as a boxer in this particular match than what you did to win the Brawl for All tournament, which. It's kind of like, well, why don't? It's not the boxer for all tournament. It's the Brawl for All. Like, like you said, he was a brawler. Let him go with that. But maybe, you know, if he knocks out Butterbean, then maybe something worse happens for him. Who knows?
If he knocked out Butterbean, somebody would have came up rich that damn Vegas. If he knocked out Butterbean, that would have no chance in hell, to borrow a phrase from Vince McMahon, that he was going to knock out Butterbean. But to Meanie's point. Maybe he had a better chance. Maybe he would have gotten embarrassed in, like, what was it, 35 seconds or something, whatever it was.
Yeah, that was brutal. And to take it backstage, there was a contingent of WWE wrestlers and Butterbean's folks in the back at the monitor. And I distinctly remember somebody going, yeah, Bart, knock him the fuck out. Knock his fat ass out. And then, poof, and then, like...
That's messed up, man.
Bunch of those guys who are yelling that did the Homer Simpson's, you know, fade back and weeds. Everybody's like, yeah, knock his ass out. And then it was just like, oh. And then Butterbean's folks looked over at us and it was like, I wasn't saying anything. I was like, because Butterbean was nice to me. I was like, he was Butterbean's a great guy if you meet him, you know?
Sure. But he's also a professional fighter who at this point had like 44 fights under his belt.
This was the easiest payday of his life, you know, next to knocking Johnny Knoxville out in the Jackass movies, you know. Just
was hysterical.
Yeah. I remember
yesterday.
He had Johnny Knoxville snoring. But yeah. Can I also bring up a really – I brought this up on social media for the Brawl for All. They announced the judges beforehand with Chuck Webner. Yep. The guy who, I'm getting to that, but the guy who trained Mike Tyson, Kevin Rooney. And then they saved the best for last with Gorilla Monsoon. And the reaction and the reception from that crowd is probably one of the most emotional things I had been around. Again, like I said, we're all in the back at the monitor for this because we were interested to see it. But like a lot of the boys got emotional when they introduced Gorilla Monsoon and the standing ovation he got from the crowd, because I think the crowd was acknowledging this might be the last time they see him. Not only because, you know, like they said, you know, Gorilla Monsoon retired. Gorilla was huge for the Philadelphia wrestling scene with WWF. He was from the area. He lived right over the bridge in Collingswood, New Jersey, you know, 10 minutes from my house. And, you know, I think everybody kind of, you know, you looked at Gorilla and you're like, this might be the last time we're seeing him. Mm-hmm. The stand ovation guy. And in the back, Mike Chioda, the referee who Gorilla brought into the WWF, really got emotional when he saw the cheering. He was like, you know, fist pumping, like, yeah. You know, clapping, you know, because he was so happy that his mentor was getting his due in essentially his hometown.
Yeah, that's the, yeah. I noted that too. That Gorilla got one of the biggest pops of the night when he got introduced.
That moment was deeper than anybody could imagine. Just between the crowd reaction and the crowd reaction, the reaction of the boys watching on the monitor, that is a down low. On a down low type of emotional moment that, you know, I had to bring it up. Like I said, I was rewatching WrestleMania 15 for this, and I took a photo of my TV screen and put it up. I was like, this is probably one of the most emotional moments of the night, you know, that a lot of people really don't talk about, but I had to point it out, you know?
Yeah. No, thank you for pointing it out. Like I said, I noticed it. And Nick, I'm sure you did too, that Gorilla got a very, warm ovation from the fans in Philly. Same for Jim Ross later in the night too, when he got introduced.
Absolutely.
Turn the TV. They definitely show their appreciation. And the thing about Philly, man, people give us a bad rap, but when we appreciate somebody, we appreciate big.
And people know. people know. They see it.
We cheered Mario Lemieux when he came back from cancer.
Yeah.
You know? Exactly.
Yeah. People want to talk about you threw snowballs at Santa, but Mario Lemieux was battling cancer. And one of his first games back as a Penguin was in Philadelphia. We gave him a standing ovation, and nobody
as we should.
Yeah.
Right.
Yep.
Same thing with like Kobe and one of his last games here. You got a standing O. I think Jordan, like guys used to kill us from the court, but like, hey man, like it's still all love at the end of the day. Like there are some times when Philly fans can get a little rambunctious, you know, but for the most part, like I said, when we show our appreciation, we show our love, there's no mistaking it. And we show it in a big way. So
sometimes we paid a price for a couple knuckleheads, but the majority of the fan base is good. But there's those couple knuckleheads that people love to get attention to.
Mm.
Right.
And even in more recent memory, the Phillies 2018, where they won the World Series and players got traded away. They come back. They take, you know, they get in the batter's box and they have to wait a few minutes because the crowd's cheering. They give them, you know, the tip of the helmet. You know, that's us. That's us to a T. And like Meanie said, we pay the price for a couple of knuckleheads, and that's unfortunately what makes the headlines.
Yep, that sells paper. Yeah.
If it bleeds, it leads.
Yep.
So hopefully, I don't know if Bart Gunn was bleeding on this night, but I wouldn't be surprised if he was, man.
And also, the one of the first people to check on Bart Gunn was Gorilla Monsoon.
See
Monsoon, you know, come to the ringside and check on Bart Gunn, because Gorilla's that type of guy, you know, checking on the boys. Not only was he one of the boys, he created, you know, he promoted wrestling, and here he is checking on one of his, you know, one of his fellow wrestlers. You know, he was there right there with the doctors checking on Bart.
Yeah. Bart, honestly, and I wrote this, he should have been TKO'd after the first knockdown. It was clear that he wasn't ready to go back and fight. I don't think he was even up for the 8 count. Like, he was probably up on his feet, but he wasn't. It was more like how to do last man standing matches where you just kind of get to your tippy toes at 9 and they're like, all right, you're good. Like, but in real boxing, you got to be there at 8. Well,
I think if you would have had a real boxing ref in there instead of an actual boxer who, an actual right. boxer goes, right. oh, he can tough it out, rub some dirt on. If you had an actual impartial official in there, you know, who can call it right down the line, I think a real boxing official would have said, oh, nope, that's good.
Right. And that boxer was Vinny Paz. So Vinny Pazienza, as he was on this night, but now he's just Vinny Paz.
Yeah.
50, he went 50-10 in his career, lightweight champion, middleweight champion, and super middleweight champion. So he was a known boxer, but like you said, not an actual official. So he's probably going to lean more like, all right, I'll let him fight it out. But in reality, it was like 20 seconds in, and Bart Gunn was already down. And when he stood up, a real official would have felt his gloves and been like, nope, can't do it. But Vinny Paz, like, go ahead and do it, man. And that was a mistake because 15 seconds later, Butterbean Daniel knocks Bart Gunn's head off his shoulders.
Yeah.
And Bart just goes tumbling down to the mat. It was awful. Like, it's honestly awful to see. Like, I mean, I remember seeing Paz asking Bart Gunn if he was good. And Bart Gunn, it's like, he's a fighter. So he's like, yeah, I'm good. He wasn't. All right. Because it wasn't long later he got put down. It was rough. It was rough to watch. And like I said, poor Buck. You can't help but feel bad for Bart Gunn.
Yeah.
Like, they look like they're going to haul this man off to the nearest morgue after fighting. For one, he's Butterbean's a professional fighter. Oh, by the way, he outweighs him by like 150 pounds.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, if this was actual boxing, they would have had a different weight class for this whole thing.
Right.
Yeah, they would have. They hauled him off the Rockies' meat case. They put him on ice, you know.
Yeah. So I'm assuming most of the boys backstage were like, damn.
Look, well, like I said, they were all like, knock him out, Bart, and then thunk, and everybody slowly faded off into the background. You know?
Oh, I gotta get ready for my match. Like, you already had your match. Well, I gotta get ready for another one.
It's like the fellas at the strip clubs when the guy goes, okay, guys, now throw some money on the stage. And like,
Everybody's at the stage until it's time to throw some money up.
All right, guys, number one's a bubble.
Ooh, I go to the bathroom now.
Yeah.
Ooh, I got the beer got me.
Yeah.
Then after the match, which was, this is kind of weird, the San Diego Chicken runs out and messes with Vinny Paz, and Paz punches him in the beak, and that's the end of that. I don't know why this happened.
I thought the knockout was uncomfortable until I saw the San Diego Chicken no-sell the punch and get back up and start dancing again. I was like, oh. I had to fast forward that. That was so uncomfortable.
He was like, oh, I just got stunned.
He got knocked out. He did the nasty plunge bump, and then he gets back up, and he's trying to goose Vinny Paz, and I'm like, Vinny Paz is going to knock this motherfucker out for real now that he no-sold him.
Now, that wasn't Pete Rose, right? Oh,
God, no. I wish I knew who was in that outfit. I don't know. Probably one of the boys were like, let me rip this jabroni, you know? But who knows? I don't know.
Move on to Mankind and Big Show. This is for... not really for anything other than for the right to be the special referee in the main event, which was bizarre.
Yes.
They fought earlier backstage. It was funny to see Steve Austin kind of in the back, like looking and like not doing anything. It's like, oh, I'm going to go mind my business here. Just going to mind my business as this happening. But Big Show is his first WrestleMania. He has the trunks on, which is always an odd look for Big Show. He needs a singlet. I don't like coming in the trunks. He didn't even have his own theme song yet. He's still using the corporation theme at this point.
Yeah.
And I put that Mankind got a lot of offense on Big Show early on in this match. Like, way too much offense on him. And it's like, from the very beginning, WWE didn't know how to book Big Show. Like, literally from day one.
Yeah.
Because you got Mick Foley just beating the hell out of Big Show right from the start.
Yeah.
And I some of that, and I've listened to a lot of Big Show's interviews over the years... some of that was also Big Show's inexperience, because he talks about how he didn't know how to work like a true giant yet, and that Undertaker had to kind of take him under his wing to teach him how to work like a giant. Yeah. But before that, he would just let guys like Mick Foley or Steve Austin and other guys who were smaller than him just tee off on him. And it's like, no, you are 7 feet tall. Like, if you don't want them to hit you, they're not going to hit you. Like, you can stop them whatever you want.
That goes back to WCW with allowing guys to, you know, powerbomb them and do stuff.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And sometimes I fall, not that I'm 7 foot, but sometimes I fall into a trap of not knowing my own height. You know, like I'll see myself, I'll look at somebody and it doesn't register how much taller I am until I'm like in front of a mirror and I see myself next to the person. The person's up to my shoulder. I'm like, oh, well, you know, I'm kind of tall. So he was a giant. He was a cruiserweight in a giant's body, so to speak. He tried to do all this cruiserweight stuff. But, you know, no, dude, you're a giant.
Like a literal giant, not like he's just 6'8". No, he was had the disease of giantism and had to get the surgery, like an actual legit giant walking this planet.
It's like that movie Fletch, 6'6", 6'8", with the afro, you know.
Right.
You know, but so, he was bumping around a lot and stuff like that. And again, it was one of those matches, you know, the right to be the official later on, which, you know, they led to, Mick Foley, you know, getting stretchered out because, you know, Big Show, he was on Big Show's back and Big Show did the nasty plunge.
Oh my God. Which, that looked painful as hell.
Yeah.
I
cringed. I was like, oh.
I want to say I was at the gorilla position for that one. I might've been peeking through the curtain on that one. Cause I remember just the groan from the crowd, which I don't think does justice on TV, but just the, when that happens through the crowd, just hearing that, you know, you're like, man, you know, he's got to go change his underwear on that one. I don't even know how there's a lot of reasons in a lot of ways, you know, that stretcher ride could have been the shoot, you know, just,
yeah,
for real,
you know, but, it was just one of those matches where it was a match on the card for later on that night, to set up later on a segment later on that night. Was it, you know, memorable? Who knows? But
I would say no.
For me, the most memorable part was watching Big Show get arrested later, and all my all my friends on the independent scene getting a WrestleMania payday, dressing up as cops to arrest him, you know.
But when they squeezed Big Show into this tiny little car, yeah. I know he had to be super uncomfortable to squeeze back there, hunched over.
Oh my God, I would have had to let down if I was him. My knees are screaming watching him getting in the backseat of that car, and you know, I'm not that big.
That looked rough for Big Show. But the end of this match comes, Big Show gets disqualified. Because he choke slams Mankind through a couple chairs, so more back pain for Mankind after he got 500 pounds dumped on him from Big Show. Yeah. Now he gets choke slammed through two chairs. So Big Show disqualified. Vince comes out and yells at Big Show. Big Show almost turns on Vince, then he didn't, and then he did. Mankind's being taken to the hospital. Vince's like, I want to call the cops on Big Show. So I'm like, don't call him Vince McMahon anymore. Let's call him Karen McMahon. Because I'm going to call the police. Karen McMahon now.
Well, his middle name is Kay. So maybe it could be Vince McMahon.
There you go. Might be on to something. It's not Kennedy.
That's another thing about this era of wrestling. It's a little bit confusing because Vince is kind of like Vince is the heel here. But later on, he's kind of the babyface versus Undertaker, you know? Yep. Where, like, they're hot-shotting a lot of things, and they got so many wheels spinning that, like, one moment, one guy's a babyface, and another moment, he's a heel, or stuff like that, so.
Yeah, and me as a fan, growing up in a particular face-heel dynamic, traditional wrestling, I was confused as, like, a 14-year-old kid, and I'm like, what should I, feel bad for him, or, like, cheer the Undertaker, because even though he's evil, and I'm a church person right now because my parents made me go to church. Like, do I feel bad? Like, what's going on? And then I was like, no, he's definitely the bad guy. And like with Austin and Big Show right now. So like, it was just, a strange dynamic going on at the time in the WWF.
Absolutely.
Bro, Shades of Grey, bro. Shades of Grey.
Yeah.
They're just characters. No good guys or bad guys, bro.
Oh, my God.
Just Shades of Grey, man.
I'll leave it at that.
Shades of Grey.
You're listening to The Straight Shooters, featuring Vaughn Johnson and Nick Piccone, giving you the best and worst in the world of professional wrestling past and present. The Straight Shooters podcast is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Pandora, iHeartRadio, the Radio.com app, TuneIn Radio, Stitcher, Spreaker, Player FM, and wherever else you listen to your podcasts. You can become a patron of the Straight Shooters for only $2 per month by signing up at patreon.com/shootersradio. You'll get exclusive content never before heard from two of the best. You can also listen to classic episodes of the Straight Shooters at shootersradio.com.
Moving on, we have the WWE Intercontinental Championship.
Yes.
We got Road Dogg defending against Ken Shamrock, Val Venus, and Goldust. But with Goldust, as the man of the hour, the Tower of Power, he's like, to be sour. The Blue Meanie.
Randy Savage? Oh.
Not yet, but the Blue Meanie with Ryan Shamrock as well. All right, so Meanie, walk me through it. What's it like when you're at that curtain, at the gorilla position, and you walk out, and it's WrestleMania?
Dude, you could tell I was excited because I ran out well before Goldust and wound up having to stop in my tracks and go, oh, yeah, Goldust is like 20 feet behind me. And you see me kind of stand still and Goldust walks by me and I start, you know, bitching at Ryan Shamrock, who I'm jealous of because Goldust is showing her more attention than myself at the time. Just talk about, you know, thankfully I had prior experience, you know, with doing live events, but you know, you're live on WrestleMania, man, and you know how many eyeballs. I mean, there's, you know, over 20,000 people in attendance. I'm sure somebody will fact check me. Well, actually, the paid attendance was, you know, whatever. But you know, there's millions of people watching at home, and then there's the pressure of, you know, you're sitting in the locker room and you hear somebody go, yeah, this is the highest paid, you know, highest purchased WrestleMania ever to date, you know, for shoot. And you're just like, oh man, don't screw up. And my whole point was like, to, you know, I'm not in the match, but I want to be acknowledged during the match, but also do it in a way where I'm not taking away from the match. So there's a plenty of times where I knew where I had to position myself, not only for myself, but for Ryan. Because she had a spot, you know, towards the end of the match, and I had to kind of make sure, and not, you know, that she wasn't capable of remembering, kind of coach her along on stuff to do. Where if you're watching me at ringside, you kind of see me side speaking out of the side of my mouth, go, all right, here, you know, this, you know, kind of, you know, coach her along and stuff like that. But it's important, you know, there's a lost art to being like a manager or a second or a valet in wrestling, because you got to also be a part of the match, but like I said, not take away from the match. And there's a couple times when they're like near falls and stuff like that, I kind of make it look like I want to sneak into the ring and be mischievous. And thank God, you know, you have Lawler on the mic, you know, be able to pick up on that. Because see that idiot, the Blue Meanie, trying to slide in the ring, you know, stuff like that, you know.
He definitely got his licks in on you on commentary. He made sure to get his licks in on you a lot.
Fine by me, man. It's like you said, say what you want about me. Say, spell my name right. Or, you know, just say my name, you know. Say my name. And I made it a point for him. I was like, I'm not in this match, but they're going to be saying my name. And there's times where I would run by the announce table and just like, you know, make a face at him. Like, this, he's an idiot at ringside, you know, or whatever. Just say my name, you know. So, and again, I tried to do it in a way that didn't take away. And just bundle of nerves, but good nerves. And they always say, like, you know, if you go, you're about to go to the ring and you don't feel like a little bit of butterflies, then there's something wrong, man. Yeah, and it doesn't mean you're scared, but it means you care, and you know, and stuff like that. So, like I said, hometown, my hometown, biggest show of the year, and I'm in a feature match for one of the major titles, the Intercontinental title. It's awesome, you know. And then, you know, later on, you know, the next night, you know, we would be involved on Raw, on a live Raw, you know, Goldust versus Road Dogg for the Intercontinental belt, which, you know, I had a hand in, you know, the title changing hands the next night. So I'm a part of that Intercontinental lineage, so to speak, you know. But on this night, you know, like I said, Super Bowl's in my hometown. I'm on the team, you know. I'm getting them. I might not be in the Philly special, but I'm on the line. I'm on the line of the defense or the offense, whichever you prefer. So, you know, to use a sports analogy, you know, I was going to make sure I made some kind of impact.
Right. That's dope. You get to walk out there in your hometown, take part in this match. Ryan Shamrock. Well, they had this weird, like, was it the tag team rules? Like, you can tag in and out of the match, which I found kind of weird. Style.
I didn't like the concept of the match. I thought, yeah, in my mind, it should have been like, you know, like if every man for himself in the match, right, you know, rolling around, you know, why would you, if you have the upper hand and you're just about to beat a guy, why would you tag out to let somebody come in and potentially, you know, benefit from the work you did, you know?
was this an elimination match?
It was an elimination. Yes. Match.
Yeah. So it was like before the Fatal 4-Way concept really took over, at least in WWE. So I thought that was weird too. I noticed like they called it a four corners match. Like the language was different. So I guess that's how they wanted to book it. But that's how it was. I was like, oh yeah, like. It's never always been the Fatal 4-Way because now I'm so used to that. It's like it's never always been a triple threat. You know, it used to be like three-way elimination matches. That was like huge at ECW. I know like Paul Heyman did a lot of three-way dance elimination type matches, and that's what I liked. Even in WCW, I think they kind of did that too. So this was like different, you know, looking back. And my first thought was, oh, this is a Fatal 4-Way, but no, it's a four corners elimination match, which is different. So,
yeah,
not better though, in my opinion.
In a way, this is kind of Vince's way of getting everybody a payday, because you know, every now and then he would throw in the battle royal to make sure everybody got a spot on Mania show. So, how do we get more guys on the card so they could get this payoff? Mm-hmm. We'll do a four corners match and stuff like that. So. That's only logic I could think to.
You got to get the meanie on the card. Find a way.
Hey, man, I'm not complaining. I'm not complaining. Again, I'm not a big fan of, you know, four corners where you tag in and out. You know, I just did this spectacular move. Let me tag out so that somebody else can pin them.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? So, I'm not a big fan of that, but I'm a big fan of being on WrestleMania. So,
right. Yeah.
There's a 50-50 proposition in there.
Right, you're not gonna complain too much when you're on WrestleMania. It's like four corners. We have eight corners. I don't give a damn. Just put me on the card.
Say my name.
Right. Say my name. Say my name. Like Destiny's Child. Say my name, man.
Absolutely, man. Shame they weren't on a rage party, you know.
Eventually, Ryan Shamrock grabs Goldust's leg by accident. Calls him lose and get pinned, and you and Goldust turn on Ryan Shamrock. So you pretty much get your wish, as you know, the character Blue Meanie. He's like, we ixnay Ryan Shamrock, and it's just me and Goldie moving forward. So
yeah, man, I won his affection. You know, I showed you, and I'm just like, ha ha, told you she was no good. And she fried off into the sunset, and me and Goldust may not have won. But I want his affection. So
that's important.
It's funny, you know, because Goldust, I mean, didn't win the match. Road Dogg won the match, retained the title. But right. In that match, me and Goldust were the last two people on the screen leading, you know, throughout the match. So we didn't win, but we kind of won, but we didn't win. So, to speak, you know, we were the last two walking off screen as far as that match was concerned.
Right. What was it like when you got backstage knowing that I just made an appearance at WrestleMania?
It was kind of like, you know, when ECW invaded Raw, you get off stage and you kind of digest what just happened and get with all the parties involved and say thank you and, you know, and just go over what we just did. It wasn't, we weren't, you know, too like, okay, you could have done this or that. It's just like, hey, thank you. We made it through the match and, you know, kind of went about our, we kind of talked about the match for like a minute or two and then just kind of just went our own ways. And I went to the locker room, got changed, wanted to watch the rest of the show. And like I said, there's a point where I got changed and went up to the family's lounge and watched some of the show from up there. And then, you know, I don't want to seem like I, you know, I don't want to look like I slid out the back door. So I went back down and some FaceTime amongst the boys in the office. I don't want anybody to go, oh, me, there's a match. And he left, you know. Uh-huh. No. I just went up to say hi to my family. And then, you know, I'm here again. So, you know, show some FaceTime in the locker room. So, yeah, it was just, you know, just a matter of, you know, absorbing it, digesting it, and then realizing, you know, how big of a deal that was, stuff like that. But also balancing, checking on family upstairs, make sure they're okay, and then come back down and watch the rest of the show, which I think I'm pretty sure I watched from the TV locker rooms. You know, there's the main locker room where everybody gets dressed, and there's a TV locker room where they might do a backstage promo and stuff like that, where they got a monitor and stuff like that.
Right.
Like, I think I found one of the TV locker rooms where guys would float in and out and watch and stuff like that. So, you know, I think there was a moment where The Rock came in and started watching some of the show and stuff like that. And then he had to, you know, powder off and get ready for his match and stuff like that. So,
yeah. Right. That's dope. That's a WrestleMania moment for Blue Me in Philadelphia. We'll kind of go through the rest of the show a little bit kind of quickly here, because I know you got to get out of here soon. Next in the card, we got Triple H and Kane, which would sound like a much bigger match today, but this is just another match at WrestleMania back in 99. Kane, of course, one of the newest inductees into the WWE Hall of Fame class of 2021.
Well deserved. It's
definitely well deserved. But before he gets into the ring, he gets attacked by the San Diego Chicken again.
Which I'm surprised Vinny Panzianda didn't take care of him for no selling the.
Right. But he comes out again. But this time, it's not the San Diego Chicken. It's Pete Rose. Charlie Hustle himself comes out. He gets a tombstone for his troubles. This is the second year in a row that Pete Rose did this. He did this at WrestleMania 14, where he's making fun of Boston.
They had their own trilogy. You know,
right. Pete came out again the next year. Right? In 2000.
Yes.
Pete Rose. What a time. Then Lawler said that Rose is so loopy, he was looking for Marge Schott, who nobody knows who Marge Schott is. Look her up. She's one of the most racist sports owners of all time. She owned Cincinnati Reds back in the day. And whoo, she was a doozy. So, but of course, this match really leads up to China turning on Kane to seemingly rejoin Triple H and DX. But not quite. We'll get to that in a second. But how did this match end? I forget. Triple H hit Kane with a chair, hit him with a pedigree. I think somebody got disqualified in this match or something like that. I remember the result.
It was another weird time when you really didn't know who the baby faces or heels were. Because, you know, Kane should have been the baby face in this match. You know, given that, you know, Triple H has accidentally shot China with the flame flower and stuff like that. And then China turns on Kane and is the heel.
Kane's also in the corporation, which is this big evil corporation.
Right. So, and you know, again, the shades of gray, bro, you know, where things are a little bit confusing. Who's the baby face? Who's the heel? China turns on Kane, but Kane should be the baby face, but he's part of a heel faction. And then later, you know, Triple H and China get this baby face pop for doing essentially what they should get booed for, doing this, you know, for reuniting, but they should have been booed for turning on Kane.
Exactly.
So, yeah, a little bit confusing.
And China hit Kane with the chair to complete the turn, got Triple H disqualified, but nobody remembers that. I didn't even remember that. I had to look it up myself. move on. Kevin Kelly interviews Vince McMahon. He says, "I'm going to be the special guest referee." And his only his Vince McMahon's voice can he do it. And his real deep and raspy voice. Then we move on to the WWE Women's Championship. We got Sable going against Tori. I had no idea that Tori was the Masked Lady from No Way Out 2001. We watched No Way Out 2001 a couple weeks back, and they had this Masked Lady out there. I was like, who the hell was that lady? And I looked up Tori's bio. I was like, oh, she was. I didn't know that was Tori. So how about that? This match was rough. I'm sorry. Like, no disrespect to Sable and Tori.
Yeah,
this match was a rough watch.
Yeah, this one was a hard watch. Pretty sure I fast forwarded through it.
But Nicole Bass showed up.
The one big thing came out of this match was Nicole Bass's debut. Which I always anytime I think see Nicole Bass, I crack up. I think of Joey Styles. Joey Styles would say they call Nicole Bass Russia because she's so much bigger than China.
Okay.
That's the good thing I have to say about that. So, next match.
Next match. WWF European Championship, Shane McMahon defending against X-Pac. Before the match, we had a promo with DX looking like they're one big happy family again. Psych, because then the match ends with Triple H turns on X-Pac and joins the corporation with China. So DX is officially like disbanded, essentially. Even though Road Dogg and Billy Gunn and X-Pac are on the same page, but that's not DX. You can't have DX without Triple H and Shawn Michaels. Come on. And China? You can't have that. So, I know that they said that X-Pac was a product of the streets. And I was like, well, was he really? And then I looked up into his background. I was like, oh, yeah, he was. Like, he had a really rough childhood.
Yeah. He did. Thankfully for wrestling found him and gave him an avenue, to.
Yeah.
Kind of get off the streets and have a really good life. So, he definitely had a rough childhood, but and like I said, this was like the part of the show where I was up in the family lounge and watched Triple H turn on X-Pac, which like you said, is eventually pretty much splintered DX.
Right. And we get that happening. Of course, X-Pac just recently got inducted into the WWE Hall of Fame. He was elected last year, supposed to be part of last year's class, but of course that didn't happen because of the pandemic. He showed off his dope shoes on Twitter too. Them shoes was dope with the six ball on the back. I was like, oh, those Jones is fire. So he got officially inducted. I think they had the ceremony like a couple days ago. So I guess they'll air that at some point. So congratulations to Sean Waltman on getting inducted into the WWE Hall of Fame. But yeah, that was this match. I mean, we gotta look at the Mean Street Posse. Those guys.
Yeah, I love Rodney and Pete Gass. They're at ringside. I always wonder what happened to the rest of the posse, but
I don't know.
I'm still glad I saw Pete Gass in my life. He's a very good dude. He mentioned me in his book, Counting the Lights, because I was one of the guys who actually helped him relax during the match. You know, we had back in the day WWE would let you do independence. And we're on a match, and he put me in an arm hold, and I reached in my back, in my Daisy Duke pocket, and flipped in a pair of Billy Buck teeth. And I turn around, he just start losing it, and he had to kind of like put his face in the shirt. So next night we had a rematch, and he went out and found his own pair and tried to rip me back. But he mentions in his book, it was like at that moment, I learned that you could have fun during a match, and it wasn't really the crowd. It was between me and him, and the crowd didn't really even pick up on it. But it was like a moment between me and him where he was like, that's when I learned to kind of like relax during a match and, still have fun, So it was pretty cool.
That's dope. Shout out to Pete Gass. Shout out to the Mean Street Posse, who I think was the scariest faction in WWE history, because what's scarier than three rich white kids who are angry and aggressive? At least for me, they're scary for me. But we move on to the Hell in a Cell match between The Undertaker and the Big Boss Man. I love this version of The Undertaker personally.
Yeah.
This Ministry of Darkness Undertaker. I know some people would like the American Badass version better or the traditional version. But this guy, I don't know what it was about him being a supervillain that wanted to own the WWF. I don't know what that was about it that I liked it so much, but I loved it. for whatever reason. But
he wanted stock.
Yeah, he knew it was going public, right? Yeah. Undertaker wasn't stupid. So, of course, this match, the match itself was forgettable, but we talk about the after the match with this one when it comes to the Brood rappelling down from the rafters, hooking up Big Boss Man to, I mean, in reality, it's like a harness, but in storyline, it's a noose.
Yeah.
And they lynch Big Boss Man in the middle of the ring.
Yeah, this is one of those moments where, like, you want to have a WrestleMania moment, but you also don't want to. Because basically they hang Big Boss Man in the middle of the ring, and then they cut away and go, well, early on tonight, we just witnessed a murder.
You killed this man.
Michael Cole's like, is this a simple?
Ring, and then Michael Cole goes, well, earlier in the night, and then it's like, we just totally forgot what we just watched. And what just happened, you probably could have ended a weekly show with and done like, oh my God, what, you know, leave people hanging, no pun intended. It's one of those things I hated. I love that era, but there's things like that. You just makes you hate the era as well.
Yeah. And like Nick said, you got Michael Cole, probably straight from Vince McMahon's mouth, but out of Cole's mouth too. Is it symbolic? Could it be symbolic? It's like, symbolic? What's symbolic about killing this man? There's nothing symbolic about it. He's dead, supposedly.
That man's got a family, damn it.
Hey, could it be symbolic? What?
This revenge for nails? Like, I don't understand.
I don't
know, man. This was wild. It's just, then I'm black, and I'm like, every time I see somebody get hanged or lynched, I'm like, oh, like, I always feel weird about that, yeah. You know, because the country we've lived in for, you know, our entire lives, they've done stuff like that in the past. So this didn't have no racial overtones to it, but it still always makes me go get queasy when I see that noose hanging down from the ring. But is it symbolic? That's what everybody wants to know.
Yeah.
I think they want to know if Big Boss Man is alive.
Yeah. Like, that's what they want. You won't see it in one of those WrestleMania highlight packages. Like,
No.
WrestleMania 15, we saw this. Like,
We saw the symbolic hanging.
It's something that's true. And so much was just a throwaway moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He was probably on Raw the next night.
Yeah.
Right. And then, like you said, Meanie, Cole just goes to a recap of the Rage Party.
You gotta get that in, though. You gotta get the Rage Party recap.
So embarrassing. So just like, oh my God.
Oh my God. So now we move on to the main event of the evening. We move on from that embarrassment.
Yeah.
We're pretty much here for. We're here for the main event, of course, WWE Championship, The Rock versus Steve Austin. When JR gets seated, though, before the match, when JR gets seated, we see behind him, we see The Rock's mother, Ada, and his then wife, now business partner, Danny Garcia, behind him, who they've gone into some hella business together, including buying the XFL. So,
and they got their own sitcom on NBC, The Young Rock, and they're doing fantastic. But talk about you have a relationship, but it's more successful after the marriage. You know, they're still together, you know.
Yeah.
That's a testament to, learning how to work with people. You know, even things don't work out, you still find a way to work together.
Yeah, and especially when there's money involved, too. That can make things get uglier. But yet, it's blossomed into crazy ventures. That they got. Like I said, they own a football league now. Danny Garcia, a woman owning a football league, blazing trails. Like, I know The Rock always talking about, he used to trail blazing eyebrow raising. But shout out to Danny Garcia as well. She's doing some things out here. Vince McMahon comes out, all jacked up, ready to referee the match. But he gets stopped by Shawn Michaels, who is a commissioner. And apparently, only the commissioner can appoint referees. Did not know that was in the WWE bylaws until WrestleMania 15, but now we know.
Yeah.
They don't have a commissioner these days, but back in 99, they did. And, of course, that referee became Mike Chioda. So,
Mike Chioda, local product here of Jersey. And like I said, Gorilla Monsoon broke him into the business and one of the best referees to ever lace up a pair of boots.
I put in storyline, though. Why would Vince McMahon make a degenerate like Shawn Michaels a commissioner? Like, Shawn Michaels is known for being a degenerate. Like, that was his character. And he gives him the responsibility.
He was in the corporation. He thought he changed him.
Yeah.
I guess.
It's the only way that you can actually explain that. Because, he's a degenerate. He's going to turn on you eventually. But Vince McMahon so egotistical, he didn't think that would happen.
Well, it probably did, but we get into the match. I like how The Rock gets into the ring and immediately tries to slap Kyoto in the face. I thought that was really funny. And then we get to the actual start of the match, which I always thought this was a great start to the match, where you got The Rock cutting off Steve Austin from going to the next ring post. And he's like, getting in his way. And then Austin is just like, okay. And they just start throwing punches right then and there. It's like, and we're off.
Yeah, that's
how you start a match.
That made so much sense because, one of the key things of Austin's entrance is doing the four corners. Mm-hmm. And these guys these two guys are number one starting quarterbacks for their opposing teams, so to speak, if I could use that analogy. Rock saying, nah, you're not going to cross this line. And then they start throwing hands. They start, start throwing rounds and it's a fight. It's a fight everybody paid to see, came to see, paid to see.
Yeah, and they fight into the stands, which you don't usually see in a main event of WrestleMania.
Yeah.
They're fighting all over the arena. Referees getting knocked out. Kyoto got hit by a chair. Tim White replaces him. The Rock puts Tim White in the rock bottom. I'm tired of you. That brings on Mick Foley. And Vince McMahon comes out, and he's in the full suit again. And we got like three or four ref bumps. He knocks out our Hebner. It's all hell is breaking loose in this match. I thought multiple ref bumps per match were only reserved for WCW, but nope, we got him here in WWF too.
Yeah.
But at the end of the night, we know the finish. Austin hits a stunner. The Rock, who I think is the best seller of the stunner on the planet, like he can do a backflip after taking a stunner. He does the big sell. Austin pins him 1-2-3, and Austin is your new World Wrestling Federation champion. Austin drinks a lot of beer, shares some with Earl Hebner, who I don't know if you knew this, Meanie. It's like Nick's least favorite referee.
He's my arch nemesis.
Baby Earl.
Baby Earl. Exactly. Leave Baby Earl alone.
He says Baby Earl. He's in the spotlight. It's like he wants that spotlight. It's like he's the champion. Like, no, Earl.
Because he originally screwed. He was the screwed Brett. He screwed Hogan. Maybe he had deep line. He did the original screw job with Hulk Hogan. Everybody thinks it was Brett. Earl's on the take. Earl likes money and he likes beer. I love Earl Hebner. Still friends with him to this day. Him and Dave. Dave worked behind the scenes. Great guys. Great.
For the show. I don't.
great. Yeah, this match was really well done. It was done in levels. False finishes, all that good stuff, and. This was like the first of the WrestleMania trilogies, and it was right there in Philadelphia, and they sent the fans home. Fans home happy, especially, knocking out Vince and then go for another round of a beer bash and stuff like that. What a great way to end a WrestleMania that had peaks and valleys. It had some hits, it had some misses, but this was like an awesome era for, WWE. As much as there's stuff that left you scratching your head, WWE was good at having people talk about the product and stuff like that, and this is one of the most memorable WrestleManias.
Like you said, mainly because of this main event, Steve Austin and The Rock, two of the best of all time. How were they as far as top guys in the locker room? Sometimes people get too big for their britches, but how were these guys in the locker room as far as top guys?
Rock and Austin were great top guys, but very approachable. And they're approachable in a way that, when I would see somebody who was, a big leaguer, I go, really? I've shared locker rooms with Rock and Austin, and you're going to, try to big league someone like that. It's just like, really?
All right. There's a big league than The Rock, who's got a television show right now, like you said.
Yeah. And you could just go up and talk to him. And then just be people. Me and Rock would talk about. Me and Stone Cold had history going back to ECW for a little bit, and for the short time I was we shared a locker room in ECW, but me and him could talk about heavy metal or whatever. Just because you're on the road, you're sharing. When you go overseas, you're sharing tour buses and stuff like that, and sharing locker rooms and you know, 7 days a week, almost what it felt like. Good dudes, great guys, and you know, definitely earned their keep, paid their dues.
Right. I've always heard. Let's fast forward to after the show now. I've always heard that there's like a post show party that Vince might throw somewhere. Is that a thing that happened on this night? And not to, we don't want to obviously divulge any secrets from, you know, people doing things, but what was it like at these post WrestleMania parties if you went to that one on this night?
Imagine any wedding reception, and that was basically that. You know, line at the cash bar, and you know, they're great catering, but you know, like there was always a WrestleMania post game, after show. And the best way to describe it was like any you know, wedding reception you can imagine ever going to.
Where was it at? Do you remember where it was in the city?
It was at the DoubleTree.
Ah, okay.
Center City, and that was pretty much the TV hotel, the WrestleMania hotel, and stuff like that. So you had the DoubleTree, and it was in the big ballroom there, which, you know, like I said, I didn't get much of the perks of, you know, getting put up in a nice hotel because it was in my hometown. But you know, I did go to the after party at the hotel, and I had a good time, you know.
As you should.
It was cool to, you know, you see everybody who's uptight and stuff like that going into the thing, kind of let loose, having a couple adult beverages and stuff like that, and good times.
All right. Well, let's put a bow on this and get you out of here, Meanie.
You guys for having me. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you again. Thank you again for taking time out. But just kind of take us back to, what were your thoughts when you look back on this now, 22 years later, right? 22 years later. Yeah, I got real big there when I said that. But like, what runs through your mind when you think about WrestleMania 15 as you sit here today, you know, in 2021?
It was a milestone. You know, seems like everybody celebrates every 5 years, milestone every 5 years. And I went to the first couple WrestleManias at a closed circuit. I went to 4 and 5 in Atlantic City, and then, you know, a couple years later, I'm on a WrestleMania. And it's one, not only is it a WrestleMania, but it's one of the first 20, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the first 15. You know, we're going up to WrestleMania 36 coming up here. And I was part of, you know, one of the first 20. So it's very storybook. You know, if you're going to do the story of, if I was to write a book of my life, do a movie in my life, you know, it's definitely a storybook, you know, moment in my life.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, again, Meanie. Oh, go ahead, Nick.
No, we started doing deep dives last summer. Hell, we might deep dive into WrestleMania 4 and 5, have you back on at some point, because we would love to hear how you viewed things as a fan in attendance.
Oh, absolutely. So
definitely would love that in the future.
Right. Yeah, so again, thanks again for joining us, Meanie. If you want to plug the pod again, or I don't know if you got to make any appearances anytime soon, feel free to plug away and tell people where they can find you.
Hey, man. Like I said, Mind of the Meanie drops every Monday morning, 6 a.m., wherever you get your favorite podcasts. If you want to watch the video version, go to fighttv.com and watch Mind of the Meanie every Monday night. If you can't get to Fight TV, go to youtube.com/Mind of the Meanie, where we rebroadcast the video version of Mind of the Meanie. But we also have a lot of great stuff on there, like Mrs. Meanie run-ins and other specials we've done. We've done Meanie Tunes. If you want to support the Blue Meanie, go to prowrestlingtees.com/Blue Meanie. You can get yourself a BWO shirt. Go to prowrestlingtees.com/Mind of the Meanie, and you can buy several of our Mind of the Meanie shirts. And all that money goes back into the pod. If you want to, I'm one of the many people on Cameo. Go to cameo.com/Blue Meanie BWO. I can wish you a happy birthday, anniversary, divorce, whatever. You know, visit me over there. But again, guys, thanks again for having me. This has been a blast, drawing some memories, so to speak, and talking about WrestleMania 15.
All right. Well, thanks again, Nick. It's about that time to wrap it up. So take us out with some plugs.
Always appreciate having you on. Thank you. You can follow us at Shooters Radio on Twitter. Follow me at Nick Pacone on Twitter. And you can follow my writing and sports at phillyinfluencer.com and phillyvoice.com.
And I am at Vaughn M. Johnson on Twitter. You can, if you can't find me on there, you'll probably find me out here in these streets. I just got my second shot yesterday. So congrats. Thank you. I might be out here in the streets a little bit more now, you know, since we, you know, fully vaccinated. At least
I got mine 2 days. So
There you go. So getting these shots in these arms right now out here in these streets. So getting back out here a little bit more. But you can find my writing at PhiladelphiaEagles.com. And, of course, we are on Patreon, patreon.com/shootersradio. Subscribe to some exclusive content for the nominal fee. Was it $2 now? Was it $2?
$2. Like that? Yeah, we went up $1. Bucks. It's not $1.99 right. anymore. It's $2 flat.
Flat $2. You know what I'm saying? You can't get a lot of things for $2, but you can get our exclusive content for $2. So go check us out. Patreon.com/shootersradio. So for the Blue Meanie and Nick Picone, I am Vaughn Johnson. Thanks for listening to episode 278 of The Straight Shooters. And we'll catch y'all again next week.
Peace.